I mean, I suppose I can tell a few anecdotes of some things that happened. There's always things popping up in my mind that, you know, certain things that devotees ask about or say, and that kind of triggers off a certain thing. I mentioned that we looked at about 8 different properties, and actually, this is in 1972, and we actually went with Srila Prabhupada to see one of these properties. And also, of course, George Harrison was there, and Shamsundar was there, and an English elderly devotee called Bhakti Pramod. I mentioned his name, I think, the other night. And so this place is in a very historical setting, right on the River Thames, near to London Heathrow Airport. And the place is called Runnymede. That might mean absolutely nothing to you, but it was an event that took place way back in the 1280s called the signing of the Magna Carta. I don't know if you know anything about English history, but that was a big deal. Really? The Magna Carta? Amazing. Okay. It was the first document which was signed by King John, I think his name was. One of those, well, anyway, he was an English king. It might have been his name, King John. Maybe John the Second. I'm not sure if it was the first. Anyway, it was a huge assessment, a big land assessment. It was a big deal. And it was the first recording of how many livestock were being kept by different families. And obviously there was taxation involved as well. Magna means big, and carta means paper. It was a big paper. You know, like you have white papers and blue papers in Parliament. Anyway, this is the first recorded deal way back in 1280. And that was signed by that particular king at that particular spot on that River Thames, and that area became known as Runnymede. That was always that name. So the farm was in that same location, and it was called Runnymede Farm. It was 120 acres, a big house with big columns in the front. And so I had made the appointment with the surveyor. And Prabhupada was always also curious to see it, because he had also heard of the Magna Carta, and he wanted to see that spot. I think also President Kennedy inaugurated something. JFK went there and inaugurated something or other in the 60s. So that farm had been vacant, you know, for a few years. So it was overgrown. I mean, the grass was very long. There were blackberry bushes and brambles everywhere. So what happened was, we came from Berry Place. There was the driver, who was back to promote. And he, because he was a little older than us, he was actually in his 50s, he didn't call Srila Prabhupada, but he always called him Your Grace. How is your grace today? You know, this is just his way. Because we also told him Prabhupada's, you know, way of, you know, actually describing us as his divine grace. So he opted for calling Srila Prabhupada Your Grace. And Prabhupada liked that, actually. He didn't say, oh no, you shouldn't call me that, you should call me this. So he was a very careful driver, and Prabhupada was sitting in the front seat with Bhakti Pramod, and I was sitting in the back seat with Shamsundar. And there was another car with this Indian devotee called Hiridakshai Vishnu. And he was the first Indian, and along with his family, to get initiated by Srila Prabhupada in London, Hiridakshai Vishnu. And he's the one who took the film of Prabhupada installing Radhalandaneshwara as he joined in 69. And he was also there with his film camera, and there's actually footage of that meeting. It's very kind of brief footage, but, you know, we're all there. And George Harrison drove from his house and met us at that farm. And so we're walking through the undergrowth. And George said, this shouldn't be called Runnymede Farm, this should be called Runnydown Farm. Because it was very run down looking. And Prabhupada actually appreciated his humor. And then we walked up the hill to the main house. And I wasn't sure what Prabhupada wanted to do, because I had the keys to the house, and if we wanted to see inside, we could have gone inside the house. But Prabhupada stopped next to the house. And so we just gathered there, because obviously we didn't want to leave Srila Prabhupada until he decided to do what he wanted to do. So we're kind of like standing in a semicircle around Srila Prabhupada. And then he starts to speak. And he said, so at this spot, we will build a bank. A bank. B-A-N-K. And so we all thought, yeah, you're going to build a bank. And then he pointed his cane, his walking stick, to Bhakti Pramod. Bhakti Pramod, his history was that he was a security manager in a British bank called the Midland Bank. And he had worked in that bank practically his whole life. So he was actually quite well known within that particular business. And so, and he had told Prabhupada this. So Prabhupada said to him, pointing his walking stick, he said, you will be the manager of the bank, because you have that history, you have that experience. Then he pointed his walking stick to George Harrison. He said, you will deposit all your money in that bank. And we will spend it all for Krishna. That's the sense of humor. I mean, it's just an absolute... And of course, George was just like, his mouth dropped. He went, what? You know? It was absolutely hilarious to see the reaction, you know. That's just a little anecdote. Are there others coming? Eventually? Is that the plan?
Yeah, a couple of them are dealing with some computer stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, like, there's a Bhakti Shastri course.
Oh,
three
I see.
Or four of them are there.
That's going on simultaneously. Okay.
There's time for retreats and meetings.
Yeah, also actually in that same year, 1972, after that, well, at that meeting, George in fact invited us to come and visit him at his house. And it just so happened that we had arranged a program for Prabhupada in a nearby town called Reading. R-E-A-D-I-N-G, that's the name of the town, Reading, it's on the M4 towards Bristol. And so we had that program at Reading Town Hall. And then from there we drove to George Harrison's house with Srila Prabhupada. And that's the place where that photo was taken. You might have seen it in Chant and Be Happy. There's a photo. There's Prabhupada, Patty Boyd, the wife of George Harrison, and a disciple. I'm the disciple. And Shamsundar was the one who took the photograph. Now, originally, Shamsundar wanted me to take the photograph and stand, and he wanted to stand next to George Harrison. But Prabhupada insisted that he take the photograph and I stand next to George Harrison. Hare Krishna. Thank you for coming. Very welcome. And that evening, because it was a little late, you know, after doing that program at the Reading Town Hall, we got to George Harrison's house about 9:30, 10 o'clock. But it was still light enough because it was in the summer. And, you know, summer nights go on. So, you know, it's quite light up until about 10:30. So, and whenever George Harrison met Prabhupada, he never came empty-handed. He would always bring some gift. either a big bouquet of flowers or a big basket of fruit or something like that. And so on that occasion he brought both the flowers and the fruit, and he would offer them to Prabhupada and then pay his full dandavats. He would get down right on the floor with his hands outstretched, you know. And, you know, he really very much loved Srila Prabhupada. We could see that. He really cared for him. And so we're sitting in a room in his house. His house is an interesting house called Friar Park. It was built by this very eccentric English millionaire called Sir Frank Crisp. And it was kind of modeled on a monastery. And all the light switches were the faces of quite chubby monks. An actual switch was the nose. So you're always like fiddling with the monk's nose every time you switch the lights on and off.
Some kind of just like a mold or something?
It was brass. It was, I mean, this man went to a lot of trouble to get, you know, all the details. I mean, it's just everywhere you look, there was really kind of very quirky things going on. But it was a very, you know, very large house, let's say. And actually George always wanted to get Srila Prabhupada's books. He always paid for, you know, all the books that came out. He wanted them all for his library. And he actually read the books. He didn't just keep them on the shelf and say, "Look, I've got these books here." But he actually liked to read them, and he liked also to, you know, actually preach to his, well, not preach, but he would, yeah, he was kind of a bit of a preacher kind of a person. He liked that, actually. He liked to be kind of like a spiritual authority within his circle of friends. I mean, his circle of friends was very famous people, obviously. Other fellow musicians and film actors and so on. And, yeah, he was always promoting Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. So we would give him like an endless supply of Bhagavad Gitas, and he would give them out, he would hand them out to different people. So that evening, we're sitting in this little room way upstairs somewhere in the house, and Prabhupada was directly speaking to George Harrison saying, "So now, in this human form of life, we should endeavor to leave this world of dark and go to the world of light." And as he's saying this, it's getting darker and darker in the room. There's no light on in the room. It's just the natural light, and it's fading very quickly, and it seemed very profound. You know, as Prabhupada's talking about this, it's actually getting darker and darker in the room. It's pretty obvious what he's talking about. He said, "But we should be aiming for that place where there's no need of moonshine or sunshine or electricity or fire." And actually this world, not only is it dark and dismal, but it's also known as Mrityuloka, the planet of death. Because everywhere on this planet, death is taking place. It was really, you know, very profound. And he said, "But there, in the world of light," of course, meaning Vaikuntha Loka, Goloka Vrindavan, "that is a world of eternal life and eternal light." He was just speaking in a very, very simplistic way. But George really got the point. And I noticed that afterwards, whenever, because we would travel quite a bit to see these different properties, he always had a beat bag. He always, when he was driving, and he liked cars, he liked fast cars. In fact, he liked, you know, supporting Formula One, the motorsport, F1, you might have heard of that. It's quite popular. And in fact, George knew all of the famous Formula One drivers. Of course, they knew him. Jackie Stewart, and there was one that he actually brought with him to the manor. I'm trying to remember his name. Graham Hill. I don't know if that. He's an English driver. And his son also was a famous driver called Damon Hill. Maybe it doesn't mean anything. Anyway. so when he was driving, when we were driving together, and of course sometimes, obviously, when we had a traffic light, a red light, we had to stop. And then, you know, if he sat there long enough at a light, there was always someone out there who would recognize him and then start screaming or waving or something. And all he would do is hold up his beanbag and say, "Hari Bol, chant Hare Krishna and be happy." He was like preaching just to these strangers that were kind of noticing him as being a beetle. But he was telling them, he was preaching, he was saying, you know, this is really the ultimate goal of life. It's not to shout and try to get my attention, but you should be getting Krishna's attention by chanting Hare Krishna. I thought that was really cool. That was really, really nice. Because he didn't need to do that, but naturally he liked to do that. So, one of the visits to the manor, once we had settled in there, George decided to bring his good friend, Graham Hill, to see Prabhupada. So he introduced him. "This is a very dear friend of mine." And Prabhupada said, "So what is your profession?" He said, "I'm a racing driver." And Prabhupada said, "Is that a dangerous sport?" "How fast do you drive?" And of course they drive really fast. And he said, "Oh," he said, "death can come at any moment. So you should immediately start chanting Hare Krishna." He told him that to his face. He said, "Death can come at any moment. This is a very precarious situation to be in, to be racing at such a fast speed." And it was very ironic because a few weeks later, he died. Not in a car accident, but in a plane accident. In fact, nearby to Bhaktivedanta Manor is this famous little airfield. And it's called, what is it called? L Street Aerodrome, that's what it's called. L Street is very famous for film studios. I don't know if you're familiar with that either, but anyway, L Street.
He's talking the wrong one.
Okay. anyway, so, yeah, he went up in a small two-seater plane, propeller plane, and there was engine failure, and the plane fell out of the sky, and he died. So Prabhupada, well, you know, he told him what to do with the last part of his life. You know, Prabhupada was Trikala Gya, and he also displayed that several times. I directly experienced this amazing ability that Prabhupada possessed. So that was very profound. I don't know actually if Graham Hill took up the chanting of Hare Krishna, but at least he was given the best advice.
What's your experience of Prabhupada knowing past, present, future?
Well, I would say that's one example. Because he did tell him on the spot. He said, "At any moment you may die. You're living a very dangerous life, a very precarious life. You should go up, take up the chanting immediately." So there was some urgency there, obviously, because Prabhupada knew it. But another time, this was in Vrindavan, in 1975, there was an English devotee called Charanaravindam. And he had just come down from Nepal, and he had brought this little orphan boy with him. And it was in the rainy season, and he wanted to go on a morning walk with his little boy. And he wanted to carry the little boy on his shoulders. And there was about maybe 30 of us, because there was always at least about 30 or sometimes more devotees, you know, the sannyasis, GBC, you know, devotees. And myself, Prabhupada, anyway, there's another story I have to get into, but when he saw Charanaravindam and this little Nepali boy, also just about to go in, he told him, "Don't come on this morning walk. Don't come on this morning." He didn't say why, he just said, "Don't come on this morning walk. You can come another time, but not this one." But Charanaravindam didn't listen. He decided he wanted to go on the morning walk with his little boy. And that particular morning, Prabhupada headed for the Parikrama Marg. Usually he would go up what's now known as the Bhaktivedanta Swami Mark. That's the road that goes from the front of the Krishna Balaram temple all the way up to Chatikara, to the NH2, the national highway. But this particular morning, he didn't go that route. He decided he wanted to go onto the Perkama Mark, turning right, going down towards the Jamuna. And that area had flooded. There was a lot of water gathered on the road. And the only way to get past that flooded area was to walk on top of this wall. And it wasn't a flat wall, it was a rounded wall. It was like that, it wasn't flat. So all of us had to obviously follow Srila Prabhupada. He was leading us and he was walking on the top of this wall, and we were also walking behind him. And Charnarvindam, he was keeping to the back because, you know, he knew that he wasn't following Prabhupada's instruction. He was disobeying Srila Prabhupada, so naturally he felt the inclination to stay a little behind, not right up at the front. And so we all safely crossed that area where it was flooded, and we all, you know, walked, you know, and just behind following Prabhupada's footsteps and got off the wall. And then Charnarvindam, halfway through the walk, he slipped and fell and landed in the water with the little boy, and the little boy started crying like anything. And the Prabhupada looked at him and said, "This is the reason why I told you not to come. I knew this was going to happen." So that was direct. I mean, that's, you know, you couldn't get more direct than that. He actually told him, he said, "You know, you disobeyed my instruction. And now just see what's happened."
So they got him out,
yeah? Yeah. Yeah, I didn't drive. It was just a few feet deep.
Oh, okay.
But it was just an inconvenience.
Yeah.
It may sound like a very petty thing. It wasn't like a major traumatic experience, but the fact is that he didn't obey Srila Prabhupada's instruction. That was the point. And the boy was really, you know, obviously, he didn't expect it. But already he was, you know, up high. Because, you know, Charnarvindam wasn't small. He was about 6 foot tall. So he was on his shoulders, and he slipped. Luckily, he slipped on the wet side. He would fall on the other side. He probably would have broken a few arms and maybe, you know, cracked his head. Because it was more dangerous on the right side, but on the left side, there was the water. So the water kind of broke his fall. But it could have been a lot worse. But, and I just, it's just one of those moments that, you know, just lives with you that, wow, Prabhupada knew that. He knew that. He told him. He said, "This is the reason why I told you not to come. I knew this was going to happen if you came with us."
Did he make any predictions?
Predictions, of course. But they're all backed by Guru Sadhu and Shastra. Of course he made predictions. The most important prediction is the chanting of the holy name in every town and village. And that's one of the predictions that Prabhupada was very, very keen to fulfill. That was Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's own prediction. He also, of course, predicted so many horrible things that are going to happen in Kali Yuga. He also was talking that, this is in 1974, in Mayapur, which is very famous, where Prabhupada talked about the next major war. And he, you know, outlined that the war would take place between India and Pakistan, and that America would back Pakistan and Russia would back India, because they were natural allies. And he said that it would be a proxy war, but then it would spread and they would use their nuclear weapons. And he said if the Soviets won, then it would be more difficult to spread Krishna consciousness, but not impossible. And if the Americans won, then it would be easier to spread Krishna consciousness. But then he said, but if we can somehow or another introduce Bhagavad Gita in large numbers into Russia, then this whole thing can be avoided. So he said. So, I don't know if you know the story, but There was tiny little Bhagavad Gitas in Russian that were printed. 5 million were printed. Secretly. And there were tiny little ones. Not, I mean, even smaller than the little, the Bible paper thin ones. Even smaller than that. And the devotees, there was a plan to do that, to flood, well, not flood, but at least get those 5 million books into the Soviet Union, through Finland, through different countries. And this Finnish boy is not here now.
No, he's
finished.
Well, he asked me in talks, I said it. I guess he can.
Oh, okay.
He's doing some service, I guess.
So, we know the story that devotees were there in the former Soviet Union and they were being very much harassed by the KGB. And many of them ended up in psychiatric prisons, and they were given electric shock treatment, psychotropic drugs, and all kinds of horrible things happened to them. But some or other of the books got in there, and some or other, this Mr. Gorbachev was chosen as a leader after Andropov, or was it Brezhnev? Maybe it was Brezhnev, then Andropov, then there's nobody here from Eastern Europe, they would know, because I'm sure they had to study that in their countries. And then we heard these two words, glasnost and perestroika, openness and freedom. Do you know these words? Glasnost, perestroika. And amazing things started to happen. And the whole Soviet Empire came to an end. And that started in 1985. It went on until the 1990s. So, I mean, one has to have that faith and that conviction that what Prabhupada predicts is going to happen. And if we follow him properly and not speculate, not make up our own ideas, but if we stick to what Prabhupada, and that's why these Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita are going to become the law books for mankind for the next 10,000 years, because everything is there. Of course, we also know the prediction of Kalki Avatar at the end of Kali Yuga. Prabhupada writes about that. There's so many amazing predictions that are made. Of course, Prabhupada also predicted that for those people who are not in Krishna consciousness, life will become more and more hellish. Because that's the nature of Kali Yuga. And he also got into, quite a lot of details about that too, at different times. But those of us who have been fortunate enough to be attracted to Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement will be saved from so many trials and tribulations and horrible things just by taking shelter of the lotus feet of Guru and Gauranga. So yes, Prabhupada was very expert in making bona fide predictions, not 2012, well, according to the Aztec calendar, is it, or the Maya or whatever, the world ends in December or something, in 2012. No, these 14. Predictions. Huh?
14. It's about 14.
Of December.
No, year.
Oh, no, they say there's even a film coming out called 2012.
Oh.
I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous because it's feeding this really speculative nature that people possess. You know, it's nonsense. It's a big nonsense. Of course, nothing ends. Of course, our life ends with death, but the planet doesn't sort of fall out of the sky in 2012. This is absolutely, this is just all speculation. Because, you know, we have another 427,000 years of Kali Yuga to go through. And Kali Yuga ends, and then we have Satya Yuga. So that's a bona fide prediction. The other one is completely speculation. It's, you know.
When Prabhupada wrote in 1956 BTG, he was one of the first BTGs, he said in 50 years, the war will break out. So there was a group of devotees who were very serious about this. That 2006 came up. I remember I was just starting to go to the temple and I was chanting and just been initiated or something, and there was these devotees who were like, serious, you know, it's going to happen, it's going to be a war. Of course, no war broke out. But just like you said, that there's going to be a war between India and Pakistan, and then like this, probably predict that. But he said, if we distribute enough literature, then it can be avoided. So in the same way he said, like this, 50 years, but because of the preaching, because of his worldwide movement.
But you know, there's also war, other wars are going on. There's other, you know, terrible things that are going on, even today, in different parts of the world. In Somalia, in Yemen, you know, all kinds of really, you know, horrendous, despicable activities are going on. Then you have tsunamis, and you have earthquakes, and you have volcanic eruptions. Isn't it? I mean, you just, if you look at CNN or BBC World News or any of those news agencies, it's nothing but just death, bombings, explosions, catastrophes, natural catastrophes, and mudslides and avalanches. Look what happened in China. 80,000 people died. That was, when was that? Anyway, but it's going on all the time.
Some earthquake last year.
Was it last year?
I think so.
Yeah,
was
anyway,
it this year?
But there's, it wasn't this year. But there's always catastrophes going on.
Yeah.
There's so much loss of life. In Sumatra, there was this earthquake, right? In Indonesia. That's this year, that just happened recently. There's an earthquake in L'Aquila, in Italy. 300 people died. So, who would expect in Italy such a huge earth? You know, we're living in very precarious times. And Mother Nature's rebelling. This is the way that she rebels. Because she's not being respected. She's just being exploited. So that's what happens.
Well, there was always been the yagya to contract the bad effects, to increase the piety in the whole world. So the Sankirtan yagya looks like it works like over the whole world, not just
yes. The
boys. As a fact, lower the place.
Yes.
Like 24-hour kirtans, the devotees being purified themselves and purifying others, like that.
I'm purifying the ether.
Yeah.
That's also going on too.
Because if we see the Vedic ideal, these offenses that people are doing these days, like majority of people, that would be a complete catastrophe.
Yeah.
So like the reactions on that is much milder than it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Well, I mean, there's so many abortions going on. That's one thing.
Cows and stuff.
And killing of the cows and public slaughterhouses. Naturally, then you get, you have to suffer. Like Argentina is one of the biggest exporters of beef. They kill more cows there than any other country in the world. So there's going to be a huge catastrophe. It has to happen. And there's already symptoms that something like that is happening there. So.
And also the symptom is that they're losing intelligence. Mm. Something that was like in Vedic times was less intelligent. Now they cannot understand.
Yeah.
Like I just heard the class of Prabhupada. He says that the Mahabharata was written for less intelligent. And this is some of the scriptures we accept. And he says, these days nobody can understand that.
Mm.
At that time it was for less intelligence, and this is one of great symptoms. Mm. You know, intelligence, I mean, nobody knows anything. He's nobody's capable to understand the real life, the reality.
Yeah, I mean, Srila Prabhupada always emphasized that human life begins by following the four principles and caring for the cause. If you don't have that, if you're not following those principles and you're not protecting the cause, then this is animal civilization. Animal life. Two-legged animals, that's all. Not human beings. So that's why Prabhupada wanted so much to emphasize cow protection in New Vrindavan, in England, at Bhaktivedanta Manor. Which that new, if you ever go there, you'll see also this, like I mentioned, the complex of the Goshala. They raised £2.5 million. So now they can care for 68 cows, but still there's, not quite on target for the 150 cows that Prabhupada predicted that we should have in 1973. But at least it's a start. And, of course, educating people constantly. That's the whole purpose of the manor, is to educate people and, centering their lives on Krishna. Not on the television, not on their favorite political party, not on their business, but center their lives around Krishna. That's the perfection of life. So in 1973, we got the go-ahead to go to Italy. And you can say also I'm living proof, what it says about in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that a blind man can see, a deaf man can talk, and a lame man can climb mountains by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So I didn't speak any Italian, I didn't know anybody in Rome. And I had very little money, but somehow or another we raised about $3,000 that summer of 1973. And so then I went to France, and I thought, well, the best thing to do is buy incense and oils, because it worked in Amsterdam. That's how I was maintaining myself when I first went there in 1970.
This is
71.
This is your own that you were saying earlier.
Yeah. And so I went to Harry Balas's Spiritual Sky Factory in Fontenay-aux-Roses in Paris. And it was Krishna's arrangement, because I wasn't even thinking very much beyond just buying the incense and how am I going to get that from there to Rome? How am I going to get to Rome? I was thinking maybe probably by train. There's this train called the Transalpino train that goes from Paris to Rome. But it just so happened that there was an Italian devotee there called Samaka, and he had a Volkswagen van. And he heard that I was really enthusiastic about starting something in Italy. He said, oh, I'm Italian, can I come with you? We can use my Volkswagen van, we can drive together. I said, yeah, this is a fantastic idea, yeah. And that's how we set off. We set off for Nice, and we turned to the right, went through Monte Carlo, and entered Italy in a place called Ventimiglia, which means 20 miles. 20 miles. It's a coastline. It's a very beautiful coastline. Ventimiglia. Yeah. Not mila. Ventimiglia. Mille means 1,000. 20,000. Ventimiglia. Ventimiglia.
Million.
Million. Means miles. But unfortunately, well, what we did was he wanted to kind of take me on a tour. He wanted to visit places where his friends were staying. We went to Torino, then we went to Milano, and then we went to Venezia, and then we went to Rimini, and then we went to this place called Macerata, and that's where his wife's family came from. There were three Italian devotees in Paris at that time. There was Somaka, his wife Mrita, and Ali Krishna. So Samaka was really kind of, and I kept thinking, well, I just have to tolerate this because after all, he's the driver and he's the one who speaks Italian, so I'll just go along. But when we got to that town way up in the hills, above Rimini, called Macerata, he had forgotten his past, because before he became a devotee, he was a thief. He was a professional thief. And he had been arrested in that town. by the police, and he spent time in jail. And the police had given him a certain form. It's called folio de via. Folio de via means that you can't come back. If you come back here, we'll arrest you on sight. Because we know you're a thief. And why are you in this town? Obviously, to steal things. So he completely forgot about this folio de via. And I was sitting in his parents-in-law's home. And he'd just gone out and said, I'll go out for a few hours. I want to see some friends. You can just wait here. And he never came back. And I waited a couple of days, and he still never came back. And then the police informed his in-laws that he was in jail for 40 days. So I couldn't drive. So the Volkswagen was there, the incense and everything was still in there. So I phoned up my local GBC man and asked him, please help me. I haven't got to Rome yet. I'm stuck up in this town. Nobody speaks English up here, and I can't drive this van. Please send somebody who can drive. And he said, well, there's nobody here. Everybody's out in a book marathon. You have to phone this devotee in Geneva and ask him for help. His name is Guru Gauranga. He's my godbrother. Obviously, this is 1973. And I asked him, I said, do you speak Italian? He said, no, but I speak some Spanish. I said, that's close enough. That's a Latin language, just like Italian. Please come. And he had a driver's license too. So he came down by train and rescued me. And then we made it to Rome. But I wasn't really thinking beyond just, well, I have to get to Rome. When we got to Rome, what do we do in Rome? Well, then we start thinking, well, this is what I have to do. It wasn't kind of like pre-planned. It just like was all happening. And we were really dependent on Krishna. So we were living in the Volkswagen because we didn't know anybody there. And I had all this incense, and then I would go down to the different areas where all the, you know, boutiques are. And the people liked the incense, and actually I did really well. I sold all the incense and all the oils very quickly. So I doubled my money. I was thinking, well, I have to go back and get more of this, because this is working really well, and I'm building up some money to start a temple. And just at that moment, it's amazing, I was walking in the street, and it was quite extraordinary, because in Rome, people are very religious by nature, obviously, because they're Roman Catholic. And when they saw me dressed like this, they'd never seen a devotee before, they thought I was a Catholic missionary, priest. So whenever I went on public transport, they would offer me a seat, they'd get up and say, oh, Padre, yeah.
Padre.
Father. Per favore. When I walked by any businesses, they would see me, they'd come out, and, oh, please come in, bless my business, bless my family, bless me. They just would say, preti. Preti means priest, preti. So I really felt at home, actually. I felt really comfortable. It was really amazing. And then this boy, he came up to me and he said, you're here in Rome! And I said, oh, you speak English? He said, yeah. I said, how do you know me? He said, well, you used to do Sunday feasts in Amsterdam, and I was there as a student, and I used to come every Sunday for the feast. I'm so happy to see you in Rome, because he was from Rome. I said, what can I do for you? I said, well, I just ran out of incense. Would you like to take me back up to Paris? Do you have a driver's license? He said, yeah, I'd love. And they took me to his parents' house. And it was so nice. I mean, it was just wonderful to be just completely dependent, you know, on Krishna's mercy. And so that's what he did. He drove me back to Paris, and I came back with my wife with more incense. And I'd also contacted one lawyer called Avvocato Lancelotti. And he didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Italian, but we both spoke French, a little French. So everything was done in French. Amazing. And somehow or another, he got it all right. You know, we made the Associazione Internazionale per la Coscienza di Krishna, and we registered what's known as the Questura. You know, in Italy, they've got five different types of police. There's the Carabinieri, and there's the Polizia Stradale, and then there's a Questura, and there's some other, you know, other, I can't remember all the names. But, you know, I just remember I had to sign my name about 36 times on all these documents. But that was us legalizing our activities. I'd legalized Harinam, legalized book distribution. Now we needed a place to operate from because we were living in a youth hostel called Ostello, San Giovanni 23, in Lungotevere.
She knows Italian. She's living in Italy.
And this youth hostel was filled up predominantly with Palestinians. I don't know what they were doing there, but there's a lot of Palestinian Arabs living in this hostel. But they never did it, you know, they never, I mean, actually, they thought we were quite kind of quaint because we're wearing robes, and Arabs do wear robes, so they didn't bother us in any way. And then I learned, you know, obviously a few words, I learned two very important words, vendasi and afitasi. You know what these two mean?
To rent.
Yeah, to rent. Afitasi is to rent and vendasi is for sale, like tahur and tekulp. Tahur, tekulp. Tahur, to rent, tekulp, to sell. In Netherlands or Flemish also. Anyway, so... I found a property, but I couldn't obviously speak to the owner. So I call my local GVC man and I say, well, we've made some progress, we made some money, we have some money in the bank, now we need to rent a place. Can you please send someone down to help? And he says, well, we're on a book marathon, everybody's out on books. I said, please, you know, really, you know, I need help, you know. I'm standing in this phone booth, and it's taken me an hour and a half to get to the phone, because in those days to make an international phone call in the 70s was like phoning from India in the 70s. It was just as difficult, you know. And he said, oh yeah, I remember now, there's one Italian girl here, she's no use at books, I'll send her. I said, okay, I don't mind. And this was Ali Krishna that came. And she was very, very smart, spoke very nice English. She was excellent, of course, in Italian. And so we meet this lady, but she advises me that not to go as a devotee. She said, you know, Italians are very conservative, generally speaking. So it's best that you wear a hat and wear a jacket and trousers. We went to the market to buy those things. And she said, if she asks me or asks you, why are you keeping your hat on? Because it's impolite not to take your hat off. Keep your hat on inside somebody's home. It's considered impolite. So she said, so the story is that you've been in a motorcycle accident and you banged your head because you weren't wearing a crash helmet. And you had to shave your head. There's a big scar and you're very embarrassed to show that operation, the scar. We had to make the I said, okay, that sounds like it might be, you know, believable, possibly. Anyway, we have this meeting and this lady really likes us. Because I've got all the papers and everything, and we're a bona fide society, and I've also got papers from Spiritual Sky to show that we have a good source of income coming in, that we can, you know, afford to pay the rent. And later on we discovered that she had rented this place to some really left-wing communist, Marxist-Leninists, and they were always out on strikes and fighting with the fascists. It was communisti and fascisti. And there was Shoparo going on. Shoparo means demonstrations. So, you know, we said we're very peaceful. We're neither fascists nor communists. We're just what we are, you know, very peaceful. Loving people. Peace-loving people. And so she's very happy, and we signed a big, long contract, you know, at a very reasonable price as well. It was a whole house with a garden. And so then we got rid of all the red paint and all the black paint and all the other horrible things that were plastered everywhere in the house. And there was a very nice basement, and we used the basement as a place to install the first deities. And my parents-in-law came and they helped pay for the marble. We got nice onyx marble to make the altar, and they also helped put the altar together. Then we installed Gornitai on Lorna Sringadeva's appearance day in 1974, and by that time we had about 25 Italian devotees, because those young boys and girls were very disillusioned by their local priests, because the local priests were not very good examples, because they had their month holiday in August, it was always in August, and we'd go off to Viareggio or Rimini or wherever, you know, or Ostia. And, you know, you wouldn't know they were priests, they're just on the beach with their big, you know, bottle of wine or whatever. There's no way, because, you know, when you take off, when a priest takes off all his religious clothes, he's just another person. And they have girlfriends, and they go to the bar, and they go to the restaurants, and, you know. And everybody knows that. That's what they do. They just chill out, I suppose you can call it. But they really are not good examples. So they were very intrigued by us. And by our philosophy also. So then we thaught, well, now we've got Gornitai installed, it's time to invite Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was in Mumbai at that time, and he was with his secretary, Satyarup Maharaj. So I wrote to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada wrote back, he said, I'm coming. Now we had already corresponded with Prabhupada, because besides all this activity we're doing, we also had the first Italian magazine published, called Ritorno a Dio. And it's called Revista, a Revista. And I'd sent a Revista, a magazine, to Srila Prabhupada. And when he got that magazine, he wrote back an amazing letter. He said, the news of this publishing of this Italian Back to Godhead magazine unsurpasses any happiness to be experienced within all the three worlds. He was really very, very happy. Very, very pleased. And on top of that, in his own handwriting, he writes, because I got this letter in January of 1974, he wrote, I hope you're coming to Mayapur also. So I took that, that's an invitation from Srila Prabhupada to visit, because I hadn't been to India, and I thought, I've got to go. So I went in March for the first big international Mayapur festival. There's about 400 devotees attended. And the Lotus building was half complete. And so we stayed there. And I couldn't go to sleep the first night. I was just so excited just being in a completely different environment. And I was chanting my japa on the veranda. And all of a sudden, this is quite late, about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And Prabhupada came down the stairs. And he saw me. Of course, I paid my obeisances. He said, so, you like it here? I said, Prabhupada, it is such a transcendental environment. How could, you know, it's just perfect for chanting Hare Krishna. And then I said, you're feeling comfortable? Because actually he was looking in all the rooms. The rooms weren't, I mean, the floors were not, they were rough. There was no marble on the floors. There was no glass in the windows. And therefore, all of us were in our little sleeping bags, like cocooned, you know, there's maybe 20 of us in each room. And we had these little strings going across the whole length of the room, and then all of the mosquito nets were tied up, and we're all kind of like cocooned next to each other, you know. And then he says to me, he says, you know how to chant Gayatri Mantra? I said, well, Prabhupada, you actually gave me Gayatri Mantra in London, 1969, I've been chanting. Since then, he said, oh, I said, good. He said, there's one American boy from Washington, D.C. He wants Brahman initiation. So he said, you teach him how to chant Gayatri Mantra on my behalf.
That was your second initiation.
Huh?
No, I didn't. That was like initiation, right? Oh, you already knew.
I knew from 1969.
Oh, you're right.
I got my Brahman initiation from Prabhupada.
Oh, okay.
And he taught me the Gayatri Mantra. That was on the 14th of December, 1969. So he was just asking me if I still remembered the Gayatri Mantra, because I asked a few devotees, why would Prabhupada say something like that? And one devotee said, well, because we're Westerners and we're not used to chanting on a regular basis, Prabhupada always made that habit, because sometimes even the senior devotees forgot how to chant properly, or they just stopped chanting. So he was just checking on me that I was still chanting three times a day, just to make sure. And then I said yes, and he said, all right, so there's this American boy from Washington, D.C. He wants to receive the Gayatri Mantra. He said, you can teach him on my behalf.
And you didn't, was there any reason for that?
Obviously, probably was thinking about that particular devotee at that time of night. He was always thinking of all of us, you know, he was just had this amazing mind, you know, he just... And, I mean, obviously I felt very honored that he asked me to do that, you know, he instructed me to do that on his behalf. And he trusted me also, that I would teach him properly.
What was his name?
I've not been asked that question for a long time. I have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Is he still alive?
I have to really dig deep into my memory bank. There's one name that's coming up, but I want to make sure that it's the right name.
My father was there in 1974.
Was he?
First,
but he's not. But he's not from Washington D.C.
No,
he's from Canada.
No, he's a New Yorker.
Oh,
but he joined in Canada.
Oh, he joined in Canada.
And was born in Brooklyn.
Oh,
went to Canada because the government was recruiting people for the Vietnam War, and so they're sending people money, $500 in the mail, so they could buy their tickets to go to the. You know, to the army base, uh-huh. So I got the money in the mail and he just went to Canada.
He went the opposite way. He went the opposite direction.
It's a funny way of doing it. Now they just, you know, put it on your credit card. Or they give you an e-ticket. So that's how.
Did you get in trouble for that?
Well, no, he went to another country. They didn't know anything about him. And that's where I met the devotees.
So, Srila Prabhupada, as I mentioned, he wrote back saying that I'm coming to Rome. And he gave me his flight details and the time of arrival. So we went out to the airport, Fiumicino. And... So we had a wonderful kirtan because the authorities there were very liberal. They allowed us all to go there with our instruments, and so we could have a big rousing kirtan for Srila Prabhupada. And we had some very nice garlands to give to him too. And Samaka was out of jail, obviously, by that time.
Yes, part of
the jail
is covering this whole time.
Oh, yes, he's covered the whole time.
Well, actually, unfortunately, that Volkswagen van died just outside of Paris. The engine, I think the head gasket, or what it's called.
Oh, yeah, that's fine, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And we had to hitchhike, you know, to Paris, that Italian devotee and myself. You know, we just abandoned the vehicle, it was just useless.
So he lost his car.
Yeah. And I told him that, and he said, well, that's to be expected, it was really, really old. He was surprised that it lasted as long as it did. It wasn't that we had forgotten to put oil or whatever, you know, that's one of a very common thing that happens to engines. If you don't put enough oil in the engine, then you can destroy the engine. But it was already, it had done 500,000 kilometers or something like that. It was really quite old. So, but it served its purpose until we got to the outskirts of Paris, then it just completely packed in. So, you know, Prabhupada was very observant. Now, in the car, because I remember Samaka was driving, Prabhupada was sitting next to the driver as usual. He liked to always sit in the front. And I was sitting in the back with Bhagavan, who was the GPC for that part of Europe at that time. And I was sitting directly behind Srila Prabhupada. So as you know, Prabhupada is very observant, so he's looking out the window and he said, oh, what are they growing out there in the fields? And I said, oh, they're growing grapes. They said, oh, they eat a lot of grapes here in this country. I said, well, they don't. Well, they eat grapes, but mostly they grow the grapes for making wine. And he said, oh. Then he thought a moment. He said, well, according to Ayurveda, a little wine is good for digestion. And I said, well, they're not just drinking a little wine. They're drinking liters of wine. In fact, they drink more wine than water. And then Prabhupada said, oh, that is very bad. He said, that means they're eating too much meat. And they need to drink the wine to help digest the meat. So the point is that a little wine is good for digestion. And in fact, there's a certain Ayurvedic tonic called Draksharastra, or some name like that. Maybe I'm saying it wrong.
It's also Asava. Asava is also means poison. Like intoxicating beverage, but it's actually Ayurvedic medicine.
Draksha means grapes, and ras means the juice of the grape.
Okay.
Draksha ras, and this is actually a bona fide tonic. There's another tonic, which is a little more stronger than the grape tonic, which is called Mrityu Sanjivani. Mrityu Sanjivani, I don't know if you've heard of that. Mrityu means death, and Sanjivani means that which can bring back the dead to life. Mrityu Sanjivani. And it's like a brandy. It's also alcoholic. But it's meant to be taken in very small doses, because it's actually a medicine. It's not that you just buy 50 bottles and keep them in your cupboard and then, well, I'm not going to die this life. No. Anyway, so then we're going into room. Then Prabhupada sees a sign on the way in, and he's not speaking to Bhagavan, he's speaking to me, because I'm right behind him. And so he whispers, he says, I saw that sign. What does it mean? And I told him. So the next time the sign came up, because this was just me and Prabhupada speaking, and Bhagavan was kind of just looking out the window as well. He didn't know what had just been said. So then another sign comes up, because it's very common. And the sign reads, Senso Unico. And so Prabhupada asked Bhagavan, what does that sign mean? And Bhagavan's looking. Which sign you mean, Prabhupada? Senso Unico. And he looks at Prabhupada and says, I don't know what it means. Prabhupada says, it means one way. I told him what it meant. And he says, I know Italian, and you don't. See about the sense of humor, I told you. That was a classic. That was a serious classic.
That's so good.
And of course, Prabhupada, I mean, he embarrassed Bhagavan too, because he's supposed to be the GBC. He's supposed to know everything. At least, you know, he always gave that impression to everybody, he knew everything. But in this particular moment, he was absolutely, completely defeated.
He was going to die.
I couldn't just continue, but I wanted to do that. I wanted to laugh out so loud. His Prabhupada had nailed him. He had completely nailed him. So we got to the temple, and so then Prabhupada goes into the building. And then we take him downstairs to the basement where Gornitai is there, and he pays his obeisances. And Satsrup Maharaj is looking really kind of not very well. He's looking very sickly, very skinny. I mean, he's always skinny anyway, but he looked even more skinny. And what had happened was he'd actually contracted jaundice. And jaundice is very debilitating, it strikes the liver. And when your liver's not functioning, you feel weak, you have no strength, you can't, even to go to the toilet was a huge endeavor. And he was meant to be cooking for Prabhupada. And he was actually Italian. He's actually of Italian extract. Do you know that? Yeah. I forget his legal name. So that's where. But it's in the Lilamrita. You can look it up.
Steve
Guarino. That's it. Thank you. Thank you for that. He was actually looking forward to cooking Italian dishes for Prabhupada. You know. But, you know, his health just packed in. And he had brought with him a big plastic bag filled with what looked like little bits out of an engine. They looked like little sprockets. You know what a sprocket is? Because it was actually dried Corella. You know that? Corella, bitter melon gourd. So when it's dried, it's got little spiky things. They look like, you know, they're round, obviously, because they're round with spiky things coming out of them. And they look like a big bag full of sprockets. We didn't even know they were a vegetable. Because Prabhupada was in the habit of taking this preparation called shukta. Shukta is a Bengali preparation. You know shukta? Yeah. It's made with karela, it's made with kacha kola meaning plantain. Looks like unripe banana.
Kacha
kola. And what else is in there? There's a few other beans, I think. Some beans. And it's a watery vegetable with that, like a gravy, and it's actually very good for stimulating the appetite. And so when Satsvarup actually admitted that, I'm sorry, I just don't feel that I've got the strength to cook. So he asked my wife, do you know how to cook? And of course, Bala Gopal was actually trained up by Jamuna and Janaki. And she liked to cook. So Satsvarup said, well, now you have to go in and see Srila Prabhupada. And he'll tell you the menu, what he wants for breakfast, what he wants for lunch, what he wants for the evening. And so Bala Gopal goes into Prabhupada's room, pays her obeisances. And she says, unfortunately, Satsvarup Maharaj, he's very weak. He's come down with jaundice. He can't cook for you. But I'm willing to cook for you. So then Prabhupada looks at Bala Gopal and he says, you know how to make shukta? And we had, you know, she had never been in India. And she said, no, Srila Prabhupada, I don't know how to make shukta. I said, okay, I'll come into the kitchen and show you. Just like that. And he got up and went with her to the kitchen and showed her exactly, you know, stage by stage, how to make the shukta. Just like a loving father. Not like, oh, this is nonsense, or, you know, you don't know how Prabhupada's mood is going to be, but he was so, you can't predict that mood, but he was so gentle and so kind that he spent about 45 minutes in the kitchen to make sure that she knew every step of the process of how to cook the shukta. Another time, he asked if she knew how to make parathas. His Prabhupada also, he had a very amazing appetite, I have to say. He would eat everything that was put before him. And she said, no, I know how to make chapatis, I know how to make puris, but I never made parathas. Okay, I'll come into the kitchen and show you. His Prabhupada liked to do that. He liked to cook. He was very expert at cooking, and he liked to teach a willing student. And so he taught her, and he didn't use a rolling pin, he just used his hands. You know, he's just very, very expert at, you know, of course, that's the traditional way. You don't use a rolling pin, you do use your hands to make the bread. And she learned very quickly. And he was very happy. You know, she was a quick learner. And so then he accepted her as the cook. And he stayed actually with us for 9 days. So she was going in every day. And not only does the cook get to cook for Prabhupada, but the cook also gets to serve Prabhupada too, with a fresh chapati, puffed up. They would come in and put it on like this. And also serve the milk. And one evening when Prabhupada was resting on his side, and she came in with the hot milk, and he heard her and he turned and he said, "The milk is just boiling now." And she said, "Yes, Srila Prabhupada, it's freshly boiled." He said, "Oh, I've got 5 minutes more." And he just continued resting. He was so informal. I mean, for a young lady devotee, I mean, that's very special treatment. This is my daughter. My daughter's coming and she's serving me these nice things. And no formality. That's the idea. No formality. And that was just such... That's another thing. Prabhupada was just... he could be really formal, but he could also be incredibly informal. And he could just be, so loving. You know, he would radiate love for his disciples, especially those who are really trying to please him, you know. So, you know, he had an amazing way of encouraging us as young devotees how to become more and more attached to him and more dedicated to his mission. And he also told us both. He called for us to come into the room and he said, the real success of a husband and wife is that the husband and wife are like one body. Just like you have the left arm and the left leg, you have the right arm and the right leg. So the left arm doesn't argue with the right arm, and the right leg doesn't argue with the left leg. He says, so if you always think that you're one body, then it'll be peaceful. Living together, because it's a two-way street. The husband is assisting the wife in becoming Krishna conscious, and the wife is assisting the husband in becoming Krishna conscious. Which is good news. It's good information. It's good instruction for householders. Of course, there are so many householder devotees in our society, and. We had arranged a public program for Srila Prabhupada. And this, you know Rome? You know a little bit about the city of Rome? So it was in this hotel called the Hotel Parco de Principi. And the Hotel Parco de Principi is in Villa Borghese. It's a 7-star hotel.
7-star?
Yeah, it's not even a 5. It's a really, really... I didn't even realize that. I was just kind of looking around for some nice place, you know, to have a public program. And this Hotel Parco de Principi in the basement has a 500-seat theater room, or hall, conference hall, under the stage. So I booked that hotel. And... Just a few years ago, I went back to see that, and I didn't realize how posh it was. Because I was just thinking, you know, it has to be a nice-looking place with nice chairs and a good sound system and just all the usual sort of things. And it wasn't that pricey either. It wasn't too expensive. I remember that. Maybe they gave us maybe I asked for a special discount too. I said something, I'm sure, but through my interpreter, Somaka, because Somaka was really into saving money too. And he was actually quite happy with the deal that we got. Then I started fretting. I kept thinking, well, what if only 5 or 10 people come? That would be disastrous. Oh, I know. Have we gotten, is it too big a place? Because I was thinking big. I was trying to emulate Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada always liked to think big, and I thought, well, we can't hire a small, like a little room like this. It has to be on a grand scale. But we did have some help. Bhagavan had come. Indrajumna was also there. And some devotees, other devotees from Paris had come. And we'd put up posters all over the city. Srila Prabhupada has come. That's all we just said. In Italian, Srila Prabhupada has come with a big photo of Prabhupada. And then the address and the time and the day.
That's it. No one knew anything.
No. Srila Prabhupada has come. So, I thought it was pretty simple and straightforward. And I think what happened was we got there a little late, and so all the lights were dimmed, because in those days we had what was known as a Fairchild projector, which is like a projector in a briefcase, like a little suitcase. And we take this out of the case, and we're showing the world of Hare Krishna, Yadavara's first film that he made. It's just like an introduction. So we couldn't really see. And I was kind of afraid to look as well. Just thinking, I'm not going to tempt faith, I'm just going to go with Prabhupada. We went into what's known as a green room, which is a little room off the side of the stage, where you wait until the lights go up and then you come onto the stage. And in the center of the stage was Prabhupada's Vyasasan. And Ali Krishna was going to translate for Srila Prabhupada, so the microphones were set up. And so after the film was over, we were called upstairs and then we went onto the stage. And that's when I looked up, because the lights were on now, and I could see not just 500 people had come, but about 800 people had come. It was absolutely packed. Every seat was taken, and this is not exaggerating, every seat was taken. And then there was people standing at the back, there were people down the sides, and there was people at the front, in the middle. The whole place was, and Prabhupada looked at me and said, oh, they're very enthusiastic to hear about Krishna consciousness. Because I was right next to Prabhupada, and I realized that we hadn't made an arrangement for the umbrella above the Vyasasan, because we were really into doing, I don't know why, but we really wanted an umbrella above, because it seemed the proper, most respectable thing to do, and respectful thing to do. But we hadn't made an arrangement for the thing to be put in position so it would stay up by itself. So I had to hold this thing up the whole time. So I was right by Prabhupada. I could, sometimes he would say something to me, and but of course Ali Krishna was one who was, she was standing to the left of Prabhupada, a little bit closer to the audience. And so I said, Prabhupada, Ali Krishna is going to translate, you speak. And so he said, well, first we'll have kirtan. Then we had this amazing kirtan, there's some photos and some film also that we discovered. Someone actually made a little film presentation of the Hotel Pago di Principe conference, which they have in Italy. And so Prabhupada spoke, and obviously it was translated. It took about an hour, because Prabhupada spoke about maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, and there's always time for the translator to translate. Then he asked any questions, and it was like a forest of arms went up. Hundreds of people wanted to ask questions. And again, Prabhupada looked at me and said, oh. Because, he wasn't used to that. He said, this is, they're very enthusiastic. I can see they're very enthusiastic. Because we were almost like that close to each other, because I was holding up the umbrella behind Prabhupada. And he was really very happy with the response. And actually, a few devotees came from that conference too. We made on-the-spot devotees from that conference. And Prabhupada spent at least another hour answering questions, because the questions were very intelligent questions. They weren't silly questions. They were actually really deep, philosophical questions. So that was very successful. I was just like so happy that, well, I'm glad I didn't, chose a small place. I'm glad I chose the bigger place, but it seemed it was just the ideal. Of course, it wasn't, because we had another 300 who couldn't sit down, but some or another squeezed in, because it was free. We didn't charge any entrance fee. And then we distributed, you know, we had enough prasadam to distribute to the 800 guests. That was a phenomenal experience. That was very pleasing to Srila Prabhupada, I have to say. And I hope you don't mind me saying this, because I usually don't say this, but when we got back to the temple the next day, Prabhupada called us and he said, because of your sincere effort in opening this temple in Rome, Lord Chaitanya will personally take you by the hand and lead you back home, back to Godhead. So, as I said, Prabhupada is amazing. He had this amazing ability to say something that really endeared him more to, you know, obviously we felt really endeared by what, and of course, these were amazing words of encouragement that we received from Srila Prabhupada. So, we also tried to arrange a meeting with the Pope, an audience. At that time, he was Pope Paul VI, but unfortunately he was sick. I had a very wonderful connection with the Vatican, this Monsignor Rossano. And he liked what we were doing. He really, you know, because I showed him our, what's known as our memorandum and articles, you know, what we actually stand for. And he apologized. He said that we sent a message to His Holiness the Pope, but unfortunately he doesn't feel well enough. But he's recommended that one of his cardinals should meet with your spiritual teacher. So they went out of their way, which is also quite extraordinary. And so they arranged this meeting in this office called the Non-Christian Office of the Vatican. There's such a place. Non-Christian. Because we're not Christians. So this place is in what's known as Trastevere. This is an island in the middle of the river, in the middle of Rome. And it's a big, big building. Very fancy building. Very, you know, costly building. And inside, when you go inside, they don't have Christian icons. They have Buddhist icons, they've got like little models of Buddhist temples, they've got tankas up, and they've got, you know, to make it kind of oriental, exotic oriental. So whoever goes there, they feel, well, yeah, I can identify with what you've put up, you know. And they're very costly things that they have there. So that was the place where Prabhupada met this Cardinal Pignedoli. And he happened to have been the Bishop of Bombay before he became a cardinal. And he also spoke fluent English. So he greeted Prabhupada, and was very polite. He even told Prabhupada that, yes, I've met your devotees in Bombay. I very much appreciate what your society is doing. You're doing the same thing as we're doing, spreading the word of God. And so Prabhupada gave him a signed copy of Bhagavad Gita to this Cardinal Pignedoli, which he received very graciously. And that whole conversation was recorded by Yogeshwar. Yogeshwar was there with his tape recorder, his viewer. And I think also there was an article that Bhakti Godhead had published as well. So then I tried to arrange for all different kinds of people to meet Srila Prabhupada, educational people, a poet, actually he was an Irish poet called William Murphy, who lived in Rome, and he came. And this person from the education department of Rome also came. And some Indian families also came, because there's a place in Rome called Eor, and Eor is where FAO is, the Food and Agricultural Organization, which is a big department of the United Nations. And a grandson of Mohandas Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, was also, or some direct relative of Mahatma Gandhi, also came to see Srila Prabhupada. And we also, of course, took Srila Prabhupada to different parts of Rome. We took him to the Colosseum. And he was asking why they're keeping such a derelict building in the middle of the city. And we said, well, it's a tourist attraction. He said, what's for tourists? Are there any toilets inside? He said, no, there's no... He said, what is the point of keeping such a useless building? Not even toilets inside. He was just very funny, you know. He was always making these kinds of remarks. And we took him to the Forum, and then we took him to see the city wall. And actually, at the end of our street, where our temple was, it was quite extraordinary because it was a very short street. It was called Via Mistretta Dui, vicino di Piazza Lodi, which is famous for another very, very big cathedral called San Giovanni, because there's San Pietro and there's San Giovanni. It's the second biggest cathedral in Rome. We were in a very amazing neighborhood. And the end of our street was this aqueduct. You know what an aqueduct is? It carries water from a spring from one of the seven hills, because Rome is surrounded by seven hills. So the Romans were so expert engineers that they would introduce this fresh water flowing, but at a very small incline. It would go from high to low, but over kilometers. So this aqueduct looked like, you know, what you'd find if there was like a railway line on top of it. And all these arches, it was very high. But the principal reason for building all these arches was to support this little stream of water that was coming into the center of Rome. So they always had a perpetual supply of fresh water, spring water. So when Prabhupada, you know, he was really interested in architecture, Prabhupada saw this, and he saw the walls, and he said, this is exactly like Vedic architecture. He said, so my conclusion is that the Vedic civilization spread up to Rome. He made that statement. Just by observing that. Of course, you know, the Romans were into demigod worship. They worshipped all the gods, just like the Greeks. Where did they get that idea from? That notion that there's gods. There's a god, the sun god, the moon god, this god, that god. That all came from India. Originally. And they got watered down, obviously, and then they got transformed into Greek mythology, as they say, Roman mythology. But actually, the source of that information about demigod worship all came from India. But when we took him to Eur is a place where they have what's known as fascist architecture. It was designed by Mussolini. You might have heard of him. He wasn't a very nice person. And anyway, he was a fascist, a good friend of Hitler. They were in the same camp, basically. And the idea was that, you know, we wanted Prabhupada to have different places to walk and to have questions and answers. Because, you know, on his morning walks, there was always questions and answers going on all the time. And so there, one devotee happened to say, isn't this a beautiful park, Srila Prabhupada? Do you like this walk? And Prabhupada said, where is the beauty? He said, all these living entities you're seeing, the trees, the bushes, the flowers, the grass, they're all suffering. They've all taken birth in those bodies because they've forgotten Krishna. So this place is just a place of suffering. And then he quoted this situation that happened during the First World War, and I mentioned it last time I was here. Because, you know, Prabhupada never actually visited Belgium, but he did speak about Belgium. And on that morning walk, he started talking about a very famous French general. And even in Paris, there's an avenue named after this general, Avenue Foch, they say. Probably pronounced it Foch, F-O-C-H. Foch, Foch, like that. But the French say Avenue Foch. Because during the First World War, the Germans, you know, they advanced into Belgium. In this area, the Ardennes. And even today, I think, still there's remnants of that. Of course, they came twice. They came not just once, but they also came during the Second World War, too. Because they saw Belgium as being a very vulnerable area, and they could easily take it. So, in this area where the Germans were fighting against the Allies, as they're called, the British, the French, the Canadians, the Australians, the Indians, the New Zealanders, because they all were, you know, anybody, you know, the Canadians also, they were all part of the British Empire, the British Commonwealth. So, the local Belgian people, because they were allies, of course, of France, so there were so many refugees created because of all this fighting. And they had to go somewhere. So they decided they should go to France, because after all, they're allies of the Belgians. And this General Foch, he was quite analytical. And Prabhupada is telling all this story to us. I didn't know this. I didn't hear this in school. So he said that he had instructed the French army to lead all these tens of thousands of refugees into this valley. And so the Belgians were thinking, well, now we're going to be safe, because now we're under the protection of the French army. But what General Foch had done was he had positioned all his big guns around this valley. And he told his officers to give the order to fire the cannon and the guns on the refugees as soon as they all assembled within this valley. There's about 50,000, maybe more than that. 50,000. Between 50 and 100,000 refugees. And the reasoning was that France was also at war. And their supplies were running short. So they couldn't afford to feed and to house all these Belgian refugees who were their friends. Even today, I think the Belgians and the French are friends. Isn't it? Am I right?
The EU, I don't think
any snuff. Some people did. But that's supposed to be enemies, that's for sure. Anyway, so this is what he did. And they killed all the refugees. Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
So Prabhupada was, you know, just emulating this idea that this world is a very cruel place. People are suffering. You're thinking, yes, I'm, you know, and you know, I'll be saved, I'll be looked after, and then you're blown to smithereens by your friends. What kind of friends are those? Yeah. There was a very poignant conversation, a morning walk conversation that particular morning. And it was said, well, we're all surrounded by all this fascist architecture, because the fascists also, they killed so many of their own people. The Italian fascists. Because, you know, Italy was on the wrong side. They sided with Hitler. But not all the Italians were fascists. There were so many working in the... what's it called? When you have a war going on in your country, but you're not part, you don't believe that you're fighting for the right cause, but you want to... The patriots... You know, the patriotic people, they were our partisans, patriots, who side with the Allies and not with the fascists. Because they're not fascists, they don't believe in that. They consider that to be unethical. So that was, since that was seriously unethical, what General Foch did to the Belgian refugees.
Something like that. It's just like, you know, bring a bunch of vegetables and just, you know, ground them all up, throw them in the field or something, you know.
It was just amazing that Prabhupada knew that also. We were just always astounded when Prabhupada would say something about history that we never had read about or heard about. Because this was actually covered up, purposely. It wasn't common knowledge.
He did have a PhD in trivia, so...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Also, on that visit, when Satsarup recovered a little bit, Prabhupada instructed him to teach us how to sing the Sri Guru Charana Padma prayer, because as far as I understand, we were the first temple in Europe to begin singing that particular prayer. Because we, you know, normally we'd have deity greeting, Govinda prayers, and then we'd have kirtan. And because we didn't know that particular prayer. But in the summer of 1974, Prabhupada instructed Satsarup to teach me how to sing that prayer. That we should sing it every morning after deity greeting. And that's how Guru Puja was introduced. As a standard part of the morning program. Then Prabhupada, I think he went, I know he visited France and he also visited Switzerland. Maybe he flew to Switzerland first and he met the mayor of Geneva in the town hall, and then he flew to France, and there was a program in the Salle Pleyel. I didn't go to Geneva, but I went to that program in Paris, in the Salle Pleyel. Anybody here from France? Or Paris? No?
That's French.
But Salle Pleyel is quite a famous hall, big conference hall. And it's interesting because Prabhupada, he chose not to give a talk from the Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, but he spoke from the Bible, from Genesis, chapter 1, text 1. In the beginning was the Word. You know that, how it starts? And the Word was with God. So he chose that particular part of Genesis because it's all to do with words. Meaning that word is a sound, it's a sound vibration. And so that sound vibration is what begins everything, because, as we know when you read the Bhagavatam, that when Lord Brahma was there by himself, he heard a word, a two-syllable word. What was that word he heard? Dapa, dapa. And so that's what actually started the whole creation, is meditating on those two syllables, ta and pa. And there was a lot of students in the audience, and there was some rowdy people. And then we heard some people saying, "Why are you sitting on that big chair?" And Prabhupada said, "I don't need to sit in this big chair. I can get off this big chair and sit on the floor. But I'm doing this because my followers, they've offered this chair in love. And they've requested me to sit in it. Therefore, I'm sitting in it." And with a lot of French people were very anti-religious. And very vocal. Very vocal. And then we heard that they were planning on throwing paint on Srila Prabhupada. Some of these students were quite out of hand. So instead of going out the main entrance that we come in, we decided to go out the back entrance. It was a lift that, you know, so we, after the talk and the kirtan, the curtains were closed and Prabhupada was taken to the back of the stage, to the very back of the building, and that's how we had to leave. Quite different from the Rome experience.
Temple,
you
know, it's still the same place?
No. Now they have a place which is quite different. Yeah.
Did you write a book?
No. I'm not a book writer.
How do you remember so specifically? You must have looked.
Well, I find it quite easy. I don't read from notes. I don't keep notes. Because it's some or other, it's ever fresh in my brain. Because those are experiences that I experienced firsthand.
Oh, shit, it's so long. Today we were also discussing how do you keep all these things in your mind?
With your love. With your enthusiasm to hear. With your interest in Srila Prabhupada. That's what keeps the memories alive. Because they're not just memories, they're actually real experiences with Krishna's pure devotee.
Have you spoken before like this?
A few times. So we can have a little question break. Want to ask some questions, then we can continue. Pertinent to what we've discussed, if possible.
Do you know anything about what Prabhupada said on the Genesis story of creation? Because now the Christian church even rejects that as a really viable truth to creation. It's just metaphorical, but what a problem.
Well, we know. We have first-hand knowledge of creation. There's, in every universe, there's a Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma is born on the lotus flower, and which is coming from, the stem is coming from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. That's creation. He's the first created being, and then from him come all other forms of life. Because that's his department. And he's very expert because he's a perfected conditioned soul. And he possesses 78% of qualities of Krishna. That's a lot. 78%. But a little bit above him, there's Lord Shiva, who possesses 84%. And above him is Lord Vishnu, who possesses 96%. And then above Lord Vishnu is Krishna, who possesses 7%. So he's empowered. He's empowered to create directly by Lord Krishna. It's not that he's independent. He's not. He's dependent. Just like we're all, apparently, it looks like we're independent, but we're only independent in the sense that we can choose to do what we want to do. And we can live out that fantasy that we're independent for as long as it takes for us to become tired of repeated birth and death. Then when we become tired of that, then Krishna sends his pure representative, or Krishna sends his instructions through his books. It's like most people in this world, they receive Prabhupada's instructions through his books on the street, not by one-to-one conversations. Because devotees don't have so much time, generally, especially when they're doing a marathon. They want to get as many books out as possible, so they spend the absolute minimum of time with each potential customary for Prabhupada's instructions. But what we're, this idea of Genesis is also emanating from the Vedas. When I visited the Vatican, Prabhupada didn't particularly want to see the Vatican. So he asked me, he said, what is it like inside the Vatican? I said, well, it's really huge. It's awe-inspiring. I mean, you feel really insignificant. You feel like that size, you know, when you go inside. And it's really opulent marble everywhere. And, yeah.
In St. Peter's Basilica.
In St. Peter's. So then when you go, and so he asked, is there some high altar? I said, yes, there's all these different altars at the sides. There's so many altars. But then at the top, there's this amazing altar with these barrow, huge, thick, chunky pillars made of beautiful marble. And there's a backdrop, there's this beautiful golden cloth. And depicted on that golden cloth, it looks like a hanging, like a big curtain type of thing, like a backdrop. There's a depiction of a dove. And the dove is like emanating light from the dove. So when I said that, Prabhupada said, yes, he said, this concept of the Supreme Lord as a bird is coming directly from which Upanishad? Remember which one? The two birds in the tree? There's the...
coming from Purana.
There's the Svetasvatara Upanishad and the Mundaka Upanishad. Which one is it coming from? That you can research.
I heard it's Puranic.
So why don't you do some research and you find out for sure? And then you tell me tomorrow. So Prabhupada said this symbolism is coming directly from the Vedas, of the two birds in the tree. One is inactive and observing the active bird, and the active bird is hopping from branch to branch, tasting sweet fruits, sometimes bitter fruits. So of course we know that the inactive one represents the Supersoul, the Paramatma, and the active one represents the Jivatma, the living entity. So he said, therefore, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit means the Father is Krishna, the Son is all his living entities, all his parts and parcels. Because God isn't so important, he only has one son. He has limitless sons and daughters. And thirdly, the Holy Spirit, that's Paramatma. He said they've directly borrowed this symbolism. From the Vedas. And I've actually mentioned this to many, many Christians. I'm talking about sincere Christians, not born-again ones that like to argue for from here to eternity about how right they are and how wrong we are. And they actually can actually comprehend that concept if they're open. There's such a personality, the Holy Spirit is residing within our heart as the super soul, right next to the soul.
Remember what that Cardinal M. Shivaji were speaking about?
Yes, it was nothing to do with meat eating, not like that Cardinal Dalmieu. I mean, France was really tough for Srila Prabhupada in so many ways. He was just so tolerant there. But this cardinal agreed with everything Prabhupada said. The complete antithesis of Cardinal Dalmieu. Whenever Prabhupada would say that we're teaching our students how to become perfect citizens, become first-class devotees, and prepare themselves to go back home, back to God, and the crowd will say yes, we're also very much agreeing. This is what this human life is meant for. Develop, you know, just dedicating his life to God. So there's nothing he disagreed with, which is a little boring, you can say, because there was no argument. There was no debate. He was too polite. Because he was very diplomatic. Because he's sitting in this office of the non-Christian religions, with a non-Christian leader. Thinking, well, I'm a Christian, he's not a Christian, but I have to agree with everything he says, because we have to put on that face while we're sitting here. Because we want to be friends with everybody. So that's what he did. He was very, very diplomatic, I have to say. Because I listened very intently to that conversation, but he not once did he put up any resistance. He said, oh, we don't like your people coming here and stealing our children from the real church. No, he never said anything like that.
Prabhupada,
he
noticed this, that it was very diplomatic.
Well, Prabhupada was being as equally diplomatic also. But that was necessary because, you know, for us to establish ourselves in the heart of the Roman Catholic faith, you can't get a higher church than St. Peter's, which is the Vatican, and that's the source of Roman Catholicism. So we could also use that in our preaching, that we're actually completely harmonious with the Catholic faith. We have no disagreements. And even today, as far as I know, there's been never any opposition to the Hare Krishna movement in Italy by the Vatican. That's good for PR. Because we can tell the local people that your church doesn't in any way dislike what we're doing. Because fortunately we don't have any history there of any child abuse or all the other terrible things that have happened in the past, never happened in Italy. And Prabhupada also told me, so if you want to be successful in a new country, then you have to follow very strictly the state laws. And that's how we were able to smoothly go into that country, and there was never any... Has anyone heard of any controversy there? I don't think so, in Italy.
You said when you first went there, you had to sign like 36 different papers, and you were legalizing this and that, so in order to be able to do Harinam, you actually had to sign the papers.
Well, I wanted to do that, because I was following Prabhupada's instruction. But you have to follow the letter of the law. And in that country, you had to follow a certain procedure with a lawyer, which we did.
So it's not that every country is like that.
Well,
America has their laws.
Yeah, every country.
If
you're in Belgium,
Italy doesn't have the same.
Yeah.
We also have like a permission.
You have to get permits.
For every hobby, huh? No, but we go to the
insurance.
Also Amsterdam, we get a license. It's called. We go to the gemeente, we get a license, and then they're happy if we follow what we're supposed to do. And if the police ever say, "Oh, if there's a big harinam with 30 or 40 devotees," and they say, "Well, do you have permission?" Yeah, here's a license. Okay, go ahead.
Slovenia is not that strict, but they're already complained to us. In Slovenia.
You're from Slovenia.
Yeah. Because some officers came and said, if you have permission, we had, which is not the right, they changed some policy.
Well, here's another story. In London, we had no permission whatsoever. We had memorandum and articles. We were a legalized charity, but we were breaking the law by going in the street. We were known as a moving obstruction. This stuff. We were a moving obstruction. And many times I was arrested personally. I never saw the inside of a magistrate's court until I became a devotee. I never was never in trouble with the police until I became a devotee. In fact, I had seen the inside of quite a number, not just always the same court, because you know we arrested at different places. Sometimes in this one, sometimes in Bow Street Magistrate's Court, sometime in another one, depending on where we were doing Harinam. And initially, you know, our fines were very small. This is, again, before decimalization. So we'd get fined 5 shillings or 10 shillings, which is like 40 cents, 50 cents. Not a huge amount. But at the Bow Street Magistrates Court, I was fined £90. And our average collection on the street was £10 a day. So this is a huge amount of money. And they also warned me, said, if I see you in this court again within the next 3 months, then I'll send you to prison. And you'll be in prison for at least 6 months. So I wrote to Prabhupada. I said, what should I do? I've just been fined £90. I'll be given a warning that the next time I'll be thrown into prison. And Prabhupada said, this whole world is a prison house. He said, this is actually the tradition of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement. He said, even Lord Chaitanya's personal Sankirtan group were harassed by the police, and the mridangas were broken, and they were arrested. He said, you go on regardless. Even if you're thrown into prison, still you chant Hare Krishna. He said, whether you're in prison or out of prison, this movement cannot be stopped. These are very encouraging words. So, and then he gave the example of the Salvation Army. Lecher sind Hell. Hell. Lecher sind Hells?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the Netherlands. Lecher des Heils. Lecher des Heils. Lecher des Heils. I'm learning a little. So, he said that in the beginning, because he also knew the history of the Salvation Army. He knew the history of so many different things. He said that, you know, when they started their movement in the 1800s, in the 1880s or something like that, they were also harassed and they were also arrested. But they never gave up their mission. And he said, now you will find them in so many street corners with their playing their music. And the police don't do anything. He said, also, after a while, the police will get fed up arresting us. And they'll see this is a lost cause. Even if we arrest them, put them in jail, they'll still be out there on the street as soon as they come out of jail. So let's just forget about, you know, because what are they doing exactly anyway? They're just having a little bit of fun, might not exactly understand that we're disseminating the Maha Mantra and giving Krishna to everybody out there. But at least, you know, they just think, well, let's just leave them. And that's what's happened in London. We don't have permission to chant Hare Krishna in the street. It's just the police have seen us so many times that we're part of the, you know, part of the scenery. Yeah. We don't have permission to do Harinam.
And in Soho, you take the whole street. It's an obstruction. It's moving. You take the whole road.
Yeah, because especially on Saturdays. Yes. Then we can get up to 100 devotees going out on Harinam. Usually it's about 50 or 60, but on special occasions when there's someone like Lokanath Swami or maybe some other, you know, somebody else, Radhanath Swami, then obviously there's a lot more.
Lokanath Swami was just there and there was 150 devotees in Harinam.
Without permission. Without permission. But if we tried that in Amsterdam with 150, we'd meet a lot of opposition. That's why we make sure we have the license. But they give us it. They don't mind giving. They like the heart. You know, that's the wonderful thing about Amsterdam. When you go in Harinam, people smile, they start dancing, they start singing along. It's like a spontaneous feeling of love and happiness, and as long as we don't stop in one place for too long, otherwise we upset the shopkeepers. But anyway, we just keep moving, and then we time it so that when we get to a place where we stop, there's no shop open there. We just do what we do, and then, you know. But it's really nice, because, you know, it's been going on for the last 40 years. We just didn't show up last year or last month, you know, so they've got used to us. But, you know, Prabhupada did say that we should actually do things in the proper way, so that the officials have no objection to what we do. And if they don't object, then they're accepting. And then they're also making, you know, spiritual progress. Because we want everybody, not just local people in the street, but everybody in whatever city or any town that we go to embrace Krishna consciousness, because it's meant for everybody. Any other comments or questions? So that was a wonderful moment in time to spend quality time with Srila Prabhupada in Rome. I remember also there was a tree. Actually, Prabhupada loved the weather. He would take his massage outside in the sun. And he also liked the quality of the fruit and the vegetables that we were providing him with for his meals. And in the main wholesale market, the local producers like to give us free donations. They give us, you know, asparagus, and and what's known, at least in Netherlands, khaki.
Oh, the khakis.
You know what I mean? Persimmon. In English, it's persimmon. Persimmon. And. Yeah, I mean, they were, you know, they like the Hare Krishnas very much. So there was one tree growing. Oh yeah, I was going to also mention about the neighbors in Via Mistretta. Because what they would do, because they knew that Prabhupada would go out every morning at the same time and go for a ride in a car to some part of the city. So they would all line up. There's maybe 20 or 30 of them, all our neighbors, and they each were holding a flower or a fruit.
Wow.
And they would come up and offer Prabhupada a flower or a fruit, one by one. Because they were so happy that the Hare Krishnas had started to live in the street. Because before that, as I mentioned, they had this very heavy-duty political group. They were Marxist-Leninists. And they weren't exactly nice neighbors.
They didn't get the flowers.
They didn't get any flowers. And Prabhupada was also, you know, he was impressed that the neighbors would always show up, because they all wanted to get the blessings of the saintly person. They realized that he was a very saintly person. And they make the effort to come out of their homes and pick a flower, bring some fruit. Just a very simple thing like that, but it was such a nice, gracious moment, you know, to be shared with Srila Prabhupada. And of course, they also got spiritual benefit by doing that. That doesn't happen in many streets, does it?
No. I mean, they're eternally benefited from
giving
the pure devotee a flower.
Yeah.
Good. Wait, what more could you ask for?
Anyway, this tree, I was trying to get to this point, there was a tree there with these funny fruits on it that I hadn't seen anywhere else. And the Italian name is Nespoli. Have you heard of that, Nespoli? So I asked Prabhupada, I said, Prabhupada, do any trees like that grow in India? And if they do, what do you call the name of that fruit? And he looked up and he said, Gulab Jamun. I think he just made it up on this spot, you know? Sometimes I suppose I ask really stupid questions. But they're called Nespoli, and they're kind of brownish. They do look like little gulab jamuns. But I don't know what the English name is, so I've never seen them grow, except, well, maybe they also grow in India too. But they're not called gulab jamuns. And we also, in that year, in 1974, I was mentioning about this election that was going on at the manor, and how this devotee called Madhavananda wanted me to hand deliver a letter to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada happened to be in Mayapur. This is in October 1974. So I thought, well, I'm not going to pass up a free ticket to India. Of course, there wasn't a lot of money. It was only £75. It was a one-way ticket. And then also in those days, if you were British, you could go to India without getting a visa. And you could stay in India for the rest of your life, because it was a special, you know, diplomatic relationship was going on between Britain and India in the 1970s, which was good news for me. I didn't have to go to the Indian embassy and, you know, queue and all that. I just got the ticket and boarded a plane and landed in India. Very simple, very easy. So when I got to Kolkata, Gaga Muni was the president at that time. And he had also started a big export business called SSSS, Spiritual Skies Sales and Services. that was the name he called his business, Spiritual Sky Sales and Services, SSSS. And an American devotee called Mani Bunda had just left. He was actually in charge of that, but for some reason he wanted to go back to America. So I was there on a mission. There was two things I wanted to accomplish. One was to give Prabhupada the letter, and number two was to ask Prabhupada's permission to do even more pioneering work. Because now I'd left Rome under the expert guidance of a devotee called Haihaya from Argentina, who spoke fluent Italian. Because we had set up everything, and Prabhupada actually told me, if you want to leave, go somewhere else, then you make sure that you find someone equally capable as you and qualified, and make sure that everything is taken, the accounts and everything else, the devotees, the temple, deity service and so on. And then you can move on, but not before that's been established. So I did that, and I had met, because I went to England first, obviously, to the manor. And I'd met this family from Sri Lanka, and they were directly related to the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka. At that time it was a Mrs. something, something, something. I'm trying to remember her name. A very Sinhalese sounding name. Mrs. Badaranayaka. Mrs. Badaranayaka. Alright? Badaranayaka. You know? This is in the 70s. It sounds right, doesn't it? Sounds simple. Badaranayaka. So, So they were so impressed with the manor that they told me, because I took them around, I happened to kind of take them on a guided tour. And they said, if you ever come to Sri Lanka, then you please look us up. We live in Colombo, which is the capital of Sri Lanka. And we will provide you with a house, and we'll also make sure that all your legal status is taken care of. We're very impressed. We would like you to come and start a center. And our auntie happens to be the Prime Minister, Mrs. Badranaike, and I'm sure she'll also be very happy to help establish an ISKCON society. And that was a big deal. So I thought, well, I have to get Prabhupada's permission and blessings first. I'm not just going to do it on my own. So that was two things I wanted to accomplish. Hand over the letter and ask Prabhupada's blessings and permission to go to Sri Lanka. Sounded reasonable. Anyway, so I didn't tell this to Garga Muni. So Garga Muni's looking at me and saying, hey, you're British, aren't you? You came here on a one-way ticket. You don't need a visa to stay in India. Why don't you take over SSSS? And I'll give you your own apartment. I'll get you a cook. I'll get you a car. I'll get you a driver. And so I'm married. It was, oh yeah, your wife can live in Mayapur. You can go and visit her at the weekends and you can stay. So he was kind of like, you know, making it quite attractive. He's like, you know, packaging this offer, you know. Come and work for me. I've just lost my best man, Mani Banda. And you just appeared. Obviously, you know, this is Lord Chaitanya's arrangement. Lord Chaitanya sent you to me, so. Garga Muni was like that. You know, I don't know if you know who I'm talking about, but his two brothers, Garga Muni and Brahmananda, the Scharf brothers, who joined in 26 Second Avenue, 1966, Bruce and Greg. Bruce and Greg. You know who I'm talking about? Yeah, you've seen on the videos, the old videos.
Both brothers are in Vrindavan.
Yeah, they're both in Rindavan.
I went to their apartment.
Nice apartment.
To be honest, I was like, are you sure your brother is in the beginning? I was like,
well, yeah, you've got the hair and the beard and the,
I wasn't sure.
And the attitude. Anyway, we're talking about 1970s. Not now. And so. I said, what are you doing here anyway? That's after he's given me this whole kind of spiel. I said, well, actually, I've got to go to Mayapur and meet with Srila Prabhupada. So I'm going there. He can come with me in my car. And so he had these cars. I don't know if you know this story, but he got these ambassador cars, which is the only car really that was available in those days. The only decent car was either the ambassador or the Padmini Pal, which is a stupid little Fiat. And the ambassador car was slightly bigger and kind of built like a tank, basically.
Yeah.
An old British, you know, classic car. And so he was really kind. He actually allowed me to, you know, drive with him to Mayapur. And all the time he's saying, yeah, you'll be ideal for this service. We'll make so much money, and we're going to export so many mridangas and kartals and harmoniums and kurtas and dhotis and saris and kamchas and tilak, and, you know. Because he was shipping off huge containers. They're all going to Los Angeles, but he wanted to branch out. Because Los Angeles is like the Western supplier of all these, you know, devotee paraphernalia, transcendental paraphernalia, because mridangas, my goodness, you could buy a mridanga there for 30 rupees in 1974. Can you imagine? 30 rupees for one mridanga? Of course, in those days, I think it was 10 rupees to the dollar, so that's $3. 10 rupees to the dollar, between 8 and 10 rupees to the dollar. How much does a mridanga cost now if you buy it from BLS? No, it won't be 30 rupees or 30 euros, that's for sure. 100 and something, at least. Or maybe more. So, you know, it was an amazing business proposition. But I was focused, you know. I get into these moods, I don't want to get distracted. So I didn't tell him that. I was just letting him, I kind of led him on a little bit that I might be interested because I wanted to get to Mayapur. So we get to Mayapur. and I go to the Lotus building, and guess who I meet? Ramananda, his brother. He's Prabhupada's secretary. And he looks at me, he says, "Where are you from?" I'm from Scotland. "Do I know you?" And I said, "I don't think we've actually met. Or we might have met at the, you know, Gorpanima Festival." "Oh yeah, yeah, I think I remember. What are you doing here?" "I've come to hand deliver a letter to Srila Prabhupada." "You ain't hand delivering anything to Srila Prabhupada." "I get all the letters. I get them. You understand? I get the letters." "What is that letter anyway?" I mean, he was, you know, quite large. You know, even in those days, he was like, you know, sumo wrestler size. I'm not going to pick a fight with him. Because I was not as big as I am now. It's a little bit like that. You know, it's quite skinny still. And I thought, well, I'm sure if we wrestled, he would definitely win. He'd sit in me and completely, you know, flatten me. Because he looked like he was looking for a fight. And I thought, well, I didn't come here to, you know, to pick a fight with anybody. I just wanted to, you know, I'd try to, you know, do something that I promised my godbrother in England. I said, "Let me see that letter. I really want to give it to Prabhupada." "No, you're not giving it to Prabhupada. You're looking for a fight?" I said, "No, I'm really not looking for a fight. I'll give you the letter." That was a real pushover. And he opens this. "That's from Madhavananda. I know Madhavananda. He was in Calcutta for some time with Kaushalya. What's this about this election and Hansabuddha? You know, Prabhupada's really happy with Hansabuddha. You know, he's a new GBC man there now. And he's doing really well. He keeps sending reports of how much money's coming in from the sale of his Radharani album and all the other paraphernalia. I don't know if you remember something you heard." Okay. Anyway, he said, "No, Prabhupada's not going to read this letter, and I'm not going to tell him about it. Are you happy with that?" And I said, "Well, you're putting me on the spot here, and I'm not really kind of wanting to get into the politics of the whole thing." He said, "Well, if you go in there and see Prabhupada, you better not mention anything about a letter from Madhavananda. You understand what I'm saying?" I said, "Okay, I'm not going to open my mouth. I just want to see Prabhupada." He said, "Okay, you go in there, but I'm going to be right behind you." So I very sheepishly open the door and pay my obeisances. And then I realize who's in the room. There's Prabhupada, obviously. Then there's Jayatirtha, there's Bhavananda. There's Gagamuni, obviously, to Jayapataka. And then Brahmananda, as he said, he also enters the room too. So there's five of them. Right? There's five. They're all GBC men. And then Jayapataka, he remembers me from the Mayapur festival. He says, "Oh, Prabhupada, Dhananjay has come. He's British. He doesn't need a visa to stay in India. He's on a one-way ticket. He should stay in Mayapur. Do service for Mayapur." And I don't say anything, obviously, because I'm not going to be intimidated anymore. I'm just sitting in this little corner of Prabhupada's beautiful room with this big, you know, in those days, the mattress on the floor and the big white cover and the big, what do they call these things?
Bolsters.
Big bolsters. And so I'm not saying anything. I'm really biting my tongue, biting my lip. And I'm not being affected by what anybody is saying at that moment in time. I'm just trying to remain focused on why I'm there. And of course, no, I'm not going to tell him about the letter, but I'm going to tell him about my request to get his blessings and permission to open a temple in Colombo, Sri Lanka. So I'm kind of like trying to regain my confidence, which was smashed by Brahmananda, you know. And so then Prabhupada sees the two brothers. He said, oh, it's so nice to see Brahmananda and Gargamuni in the same room. And he started reminiscing about them, because, you know, they're always apart, because Brahmananda traveled a lot with Prabhupada as his secretary, DVC secretary. You know, he also was in Africa for a long time, in Kenya, East Africa, and also in Nigeria and so many other African countries. And then he said, I'm just now remembering how both of you were put under so much stress and difficulty when I sent you both to preach in Karachi, in what was then West Pakistan, because it used to be on one side of India, West Pakistan, the other side, East Pakistan, which of course is no longer there. It's now Bangladesh, because in 1971, India joined forces with the local people there, because first of all, they didn't speak Urdu, they spoke Bengali, and they were quite different people. They didn't like being, you know, kind of like governed by the Pakistanis on this side of India, which was like really far away from that side. This is a very weird kind of a combination. West Pakistan, East Pakistan, right in the middle is India. So they had this huge war, which the West Pakistanis lost with the help of India. Anyway, so what happened was these two brothers went to Karachi on Prabhupada's instruction as sannyasis, and that's when the war broke out. And all of a sudden, they were a target, because the people thought that they were CIA agents. And they were shot at. Fortunately, the guy wasn't a very good aimer. But they were obviously, you know, a little bit, you know, oh, this is dangerous. Because they were in somebody's roof, having a pandal. Because, you know, there's a few Hindu families still living, even today. I mean, I've been to Karachi, not purposely. We were flying from England, from London, the family, my wife, my son, and my daughter, to Delhi. But this is in 1980, and the whole of the Delhi airport was covered in thick fog, and they didn't have any proper radar. So it was a Pan Am flight, and they decided to land unofficially at Karachi. And we had to be there for a whole day for the fog to clear. So we took in the sights of Karachi. There's not much to see there, but we were actually on a mission to meet my godbrother who was preaching there. So we also met some Hindu families. And so they had to leave. They're actually told by the authorities, if you want to leave in one piece, you have to leave now. So there were no flights between Karachi and Delhi. They were completely stopped, obviously, because India was at war with Pakistan. This is a big war in 1971. And so the only way they could get to India was they could fly from, you know, by PIA, Pakistan International Airlines, from Karachi to Colombo in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka was neutral. It wasn't involved in that 1971 India-Pakistan war. And then from there they had to wait, change planes, and then fly to Delhi. So it was like the two sides of the triangle instead of going direct. In the meantime, Prabhupada had been told wrongly by devotees in Mumbai. They had read some newspaper clipping that two American swamis had been killed while preaching in Karachi. And of course they were on their way to Colombo, and then they had to wait there for some time to get connecting flight to Delhi. So when Prabhupada heard this, he started crying. He said, it's my fault. I sent them to such a dangerous place. What can I do? I feel so bad that two of my sons have been killed in action. You know, in action meaning preaching Krishna consciousness. But what had happened was it'd been delayed, and then because they had to go to Colombo, and then they flew to Delhi. And so when they both appeared in Prabhupada's room where he was staying, he immediately got up and embraced the both of them. And he was sobbing tears of joy this time. and both their kurtas were completely wet, sodden wet by Prabhupada's tears of happiness that actually that wasn't true, that they were still alive and actually nothing happened to them. So that was, you know, that was a revelation to me. I wasn't expecting that. You know, I was just going to, you know. Anyway, but then Prabhupada said, you know, there is a Bengali saying. And then he says a Bengali about Sri Lanka. And then, of course, even Jayaprataka, his Bengali wasn't that expert at that time. So Prabhupada translated, he said, anyone, you know, this is a Bengali saying, anyone who steps foot on Lanka becomes a Ravana. He said, that's why you'll never find any Bengalis living in Sri Lanka. That's what they say. Anyone who steps foot on Lanka becomes a Ravana. And I'm going, God. Oh, why did Prabhupada have to say that now? Why did he have to say that now? Because, I mean, you know, I was thinking, how can I not say, I want to go there. Because it would have been really bad timing, obviously, because, you know, Prabhupada was discouraging, literally, the thought of going to Sri Lanka. So now I was seriously speechless, because, you know, if Prabhupada was going to ask me directly, well, what are you doing here? What's your plan? I wasn't going to even mention that. I couldn't, you know, because it just was totally seriously bad timing. So I'm praying, Prabhupada, don't ask me any questions, please, don't ask me any. I'm saying this to myself. And then there was a moment of silence. This Prabhupada would speak, he would deliver a particular message, then he would withdraw. And he'd usually kind of like stretch, put his hands behind his head, and go like this, or, you know, he just do something. It's sort of, you know, he was gathering his thoughts. And then all of a sudden he said, Dhananjaya, he should be the president of Vrindavan Temple. And I went, where did that come from? I didn't say anything like that. I wasn't even thinking that. And then all these GBC men go, Jai Prabhupada, that's a great idea. Okay. And so then Prabhupada said, so everyone agrees? This is a good idea? Yes, Prabhupada. He's British. He's on a one-way ticket. Doesn't need a visa. Yeah, that's the place. That's where you should go. So the Prabhupada says, so everyone's unanimous? That's Bhavananda, Jayatirtha, Jayapataka, Ramananda, Gargamani. Yes, Prabhupada, we're completely behind you. All right, then the Prabhupada said, I think we have a quorum of GBC. Quorum means a sufficient number to pass a GBC resolution. So right there and then, Prabhupada takes out from his drawer, from his little table, a little lined exercise book, a school exercise book, you know, these little ones with the cardboard covers, like 50 paisa or whatever. And he starts writing in longhand. He said, today there was a quorum meeting of the GBC and the resolution was passed that Dhananjaya Das should become the temple president of Vrindavan. Then Prabhupada signed it and dated it. He said, now you all sign. And in his presence, the book was passed around, you know, to Bhavananda, then Jayatirtha, then Jayapataka, then Ramananda, Gargamuni. And I'm sitting there thinking, I haven't said anything yet. He's not even asking my opinion. But I was thinking, this is quite extraordinary. This is really not what I was expecting to happen. But it's obviously out of my control. But I'm saying this all to myself. I'm not making any eye movements or kind of like fidgeting or, you know, I'm just sitting there in a corner. And then Prabhupada said, okay, all your GBC men leave. Dhananjaya, you stay. So they all obviously leave the room. And I'm sitting there with Prabhupada alone. And he said, so, you like this idea? I said, well, then I tried to be a little funny. philosophical. So, or he said, or would you prefer to do service in Mayapur? That was the option he gave. He said, would you like this idea, or would you like the idea of doing service in Mayapur? I said, Prabhupada, whether you bite a mango from the top or the bottom, it's still a mango, and it's still sweet. So, obviously, this is what you want me to do. You want me to go to Vrindavan, so I'm willing to follow your instruction and your request. Then Prabhupada, the next question comes up. Where is your wife? I said, she's in England at Bhaktivedanta Manor. He said, call her here immediately. And then he said, wherever the wife is situated, the husband will surely go there. He said, I don't want you going back to England. I want you to stay in India. So you call your wife and you tell her that now you're the president of Vrindavan and you're going to be staying there in India. And so obviously I do that. I call my wife and she ends up selling all my new clothes that I just purchased at the Gopinima festival. Yeah, I bought kurtas and dhotis and waistcoats and silk shawls, and because you know it's really cheap in those days. But she had to make the money. She had to make £75 somewhere or another. So that was the sacrifice I made. Of course, I couldn't do anything about it anyway because they're all there in England, and we weren't going back there. And after all, that's where they're all made in India. Dhotis, kurtas, waistcoats. A small price to pay for this amazing opportunity that Prabhupada pretty much decided upon. But then he goes on, I was just mentioning, you know, previously that Prabhupada was also very diplomatic. So he tells me, he says, when you go to Vrindavan, you'll find that Harikesh is there. Harikesh was a brahmachari at that time. And then he tells me, he said, Harikesh thinks he's the president of Vrindavan. So when you go there, you can't tell him, I've just made you the president. So when you go there, you have to do some service. But if he asks you why you're there, you tell him it's because of this reason. You don't tell him it's because of that reason. Otherwise, he'll get very upset. Even after the GBC resolution has just been made, Prabhupada is still using diplomacy. So he said, so you will find one Indian devotee there called Pranav, and I want you to work with him and look for land that can be purchased with sweet water. There has to be sweet water available on that land. Because we have some cows we're keeping on the building site of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And I want that there should be sufficient fodder for those cows, and there should also be sweet water for them to drink. So that's what you have to tell Harikesh, that I'm sending you to Vrindavan and I'm instructing you to look for land with sweet water. And if he says, is there any other reason you happen to be here, you tell him no. So the only reason that you're there is to look for land with sweet water for the cows. So I said, okay, I can do that.
That's amazing.
And anyway, so then I get to Vrindavan.
You never mentioned the letter about Sri Lanka.
I never mentioned anything about Sri Lanka. I just went out the window, you know. How could it? Because it was completely clashing with what Prabhupada wanted me to do. Like I said, Prabhupada really gave me so many instructions and so much guidance. You know, absolutely phenomenal amounts of time and training and just so many amazing things. This is like the tip of the iceberg. I'm telling you. So I go to Vrindavan. And I meet Gunarnava, who's a Welsh devotee. And actually, I was kind of responsible for sending Gunarnava to Vrindavan, because in 1972, when I was the temple president, Prabhupada called me and said, are there any good men that we can send to Vrindavan? Any good men that know anything about construction work? Because this Kiradaksha Vishnu, Prabhupada's first Indian disciple in London, was there. He was the president, and he had acquired this donation of land, and then they started the construction work. But he needed some Western minds, not just Indians, because Indians are, unfortunately, I have to say this, but they're not very honest. They like to cheat. So Prabhupada wanted some Western people there, and especially British. Actually, he liked the British. He told me that. He said that the British, they understand the Indian mentality. And so they make a good combination. British temple president, Indian temple devotees. He said that is a first-class combination. I'm just saying that because that's what he told me. So, when Prabhupada asked me that question in 1972, I had a quick Hastagosti meeting with all the resident devotees. And so two devotees, a Scottish devotee called Smara Hari, said that he had worked as a brickie. A brickie is someone who is a bricklayer who knows how to build walls with bricks. I said, that sounds like construction experience. And then Ganarva said, well, I've had some experience installing air conditioning in factories in Wales, in Cardiff. I said, that kind of sounds like construction work as well. Yeah, okay. Let's go to Prabhupada. So, because nobody else had any kind of similar kind of experience. So then I go down with these two brahmacharis, the repair vacancies, and I said, Prabhupada, here's two willing and able devotees who can help with the construction. So Prabhupada doesn't even ask them what their experience is. He's just, okay, so now you go out and you collect your tickets for India. So they bought some incense, went out in the street, sold the incense, and they got their ticket money, and then they left. They went. And they're both British. One was Scottish, one was Welsh. That's part of Britain. So they didn't need visas. And so Ganarva was still there in 1974. He'd been there for 2 years. And he was kind of looking after the cows. They're beautiful, brown. They're called Sahiwal cows. And we got them from the from Agra, from the army base. There's a big army base in Agra. And they keep their own cows for their own consumption. And so we had purchased a few of these cows. And they were drought-resistant cows. They could manage a lot of heat. So Ganarva obviously says, oh, what are you doing in Vrindavan? I said, well, I've come here to look for land with sweet water. He said, that's a tough one. So around here it's all salty water. I said, well, I'm going to be going up with this devotee called Pranab. He said, oh yeah, Pranab's here, and so on, like that. And then he said, do you want to come to Arti? And I said, sure. And of course we go to Prabhupada's. At that time, the temple wasn't open in 1974. So Prabhupada's house was used, the main living room, the darshan room, was used as a temple room. So we go down to, we're at the front because his office and his, and he tells me I can stay with him in his office. And these charpais, you know, a charpai is made with string with four legs. Charpai means four legs, basically. It's just a rope bed that's on a bamboo frame with four legs. And it kind of sags in the middle after a while. And so anyway, he looks after me and he shows me where to bathe. There's a well, it's called the Prabhupada well, and that was the water that we used for bathing. There was no running water. And I thought that's kind of interesting. And anyway, so then we get bathed and dressed and we go down to the to Prabhupada's house. And we go into the front door, and the first devotee I meet is Harikesh. And Harikesh says, Dhananjaya! Because he knew me from before. what are you doing here? It's the first question he asks. Well, I've come here because Prabhupada sent me to look for a land with sweet water. Is there any other reason you're here? I mean, Prabhupada actually completely sussed him. Totally. I said, no. That's the only... You sure? He wasn't even, you know, convinced. He was still a little bit on edge, you know. Are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure. That's the only reason I'm here. Okay. And that was about the only conversation we ever had. And anyway, so I was there looking at land with Pranav, testing the water, and it was really salty. You know, we just didn't have any success. And Tejas, who had mentioned, had bought those deities, the Radha Gokulananda deities for the Delhi Pandal, he came to visit. And Prabhupada said about Tejas, it said, Tejas, your job is to stay in Delhi and collect money for Vrindavan. And in fact, he said to him, so he would know for sure, I'm letting you know that Tejas means Delhi and Delhi means Tejas. He actually told it to his face. Tejas means Delhi and Delhi means Tejas. In other words, you're the gateway to Vrindavan. If anyone wants to come and visit our temple, only you who are going to stay in Delhi until the temple is opened, you're going to be there collecting, so we can have our Vrindavan temple. So you got stuck with that kind of, that little, what do you call it, saying, or a motto, you might want to call it a motto. Tejas means Delhi and Delhi means Tejas. So he said, oh, because I'd met him actually, because briefly we landed in Delhi, and I met him. Actually, I got on really well with him. He was really a very interesting personality. Very, very intelligent. He had come to India before he was a devotee, working for the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps is a big movement in America. And he had been stationed in Andhra Pradesh. And he had learned to speak Telugu, which is the local language there, fluently. Absolutely, he picked it up just like that. And that's not an easy language. It's squiggles.
It's
South Indian, it's a Dravidian language. It's Dravidian. There's five provinces, and you know, Kannada, which is the language of Karnataka, Malayalam, which is the language of Kerala, and Tamil and Telugu are the, you know, they're all squiggly. And it's funny because Prabhupada actually described the sound of South Indian, like, please, I'm not trying to give it any fancy. But he said that the sound of those languages, those Dravidian languages, is like rolling marbles in a glass bottle or a glass jar with a little bit of water. You put a little bit of water in some glass marbles in a glass jar, and you tip it up and down.
Next joke in Bengali says, put three marbles on your pot. Oh, whatever you say.
Prabhupada, like I said, had an amazing sense of humor. You know what he said about jackfruit? You know what jackfruit is?
Yes.
When you get very ripe jackfruit. It's delicious. But Prabhupada said that eating jackfruit is like drinking or sucking sugarcane juice through a Muslim's beard.
It's pretty gross.
Why is that?
Because it's very stringy. It's very stringy. It's like sucking sugarcane just through a Muslim beard.
And stick it in, gets on your hand and
you're like... Oh yeah. That's when it's kacha. When it's kacha, you get that white milky stuff.
Yeah, you meant to pray there and get those hajis out of hajjah.
But the British called it the pot roast plant. Because it tasted just like, it was cooked in a certain way, just like pot roast. And if you cook it another way, it tastes just like chicken. Prabhupada said all the meat flavors are there in the vegetable kingdom. So kachakatal is an amazing vegetable. You can make fantastic pakoras from kachakatal. Of course, I lived in Bengal for 3 years, and I got really quite hooked on especially kachakatal. And even there's a saying that someone who's, perhaps very young, but they're also very, what's the right word? And they're very smart, and they can answer back, even although they're very young, they can answer back in a very, very intelligent way. What do you say, what's the English word for that? That's more close to the Bengali. That's more close to the Bengali. But the Bengali, they say, paka ichur. Paka ichur. Ichur is a baby jackfruit. And of course, how can a baby jackfruit be paka? Paka means ripe. Paka ichur is a complete antithesis. Because a baby jackfruit is not ripe. It's not paka. So someone who's a smart aleck is known as a paka ichur. Am I right? Yeah.
It's like a catch 22. Another
way
they express
it also,
badmash.
Yeah, badmash just means. Yeah. That's a polite way of saying it. It can mean also a lot more than that. Dishonest.
So what happened with Tejas Prabhu?
Yeah. So he invited me to come and do service with him in Delhi. Because he was alone in number 19 Todramal Lane, which is in Bengali Market. And it was this long, strange-looking building, painted yellow, that he called the Yellow Submarine. You know that song, the Beatles song? We all live in the yellow submarine, a yellow submarine.
I think it might be up there.
So it was long and yellow, and that's where the original deities, Radha Parthasarathi, were installed in this tiny little building, which of course are now in a very beautiful location in the New Delhi Temple. Has anyone been to the New Delhi Temple? It's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. It took a long time for those deities to arrive there. They went in a very circuitous way, not in a straightforward way. So I wrote to Srila Prabhupada, I said, Srila Prabhupada, I've been in Vrindavan for so long. And we looked, Pranav and myself looked for land with sweet water, but alas, we couldn't find any sweet water. We found land, but not sweet water. And Tejas has invited me to preach with him in Delhi. So, with your permission, I'm going to move to Delhi because I don't see much happening in Vrindavan. So then Prabhupada wrote back, yes, he said, you have my approval. After all, an idle mind is a devil's workshop, and I don't want your mind to be idle when residing in Vrindavan. No mention about being the temple president anymore. That was just kind of like, you know, that happened in the previous, you know, yoga. Anyway, so then I ended up with Tejas, and I got to know him extremely well. Then we ended up going to a place called Muradabad, where we made a lot of life members there. And time was just going by, you know, things were going on. I was happy, I was active, and I kept wondering, well, has Prabhupada kind of forgotten about that resolution of what was supposed to happen there, you know? But it was all, I suppose, part of the whole learning process, because Tejas promised me he'd teach me how to make life members, and I thought, well, that could also come in handy when I eventually become the president of Vrindavan. That's a good source of income. And then it came round to Gaur Purnima, 1975, and finally Prabhupada writes to me, and he requests me to come to Mayapur. And so by that time, the word had gone out that Prabhupada had chosen a householder, of all people, to be the president of the most prestigious temple in India, in Vrindavan, which is, after all, a place for renunciates. In other words, this should be the job of a sannyasi, and not a householder. You understand my point? Like I said, Prabhupada, you know, he would make decisions, but also at the same time, he would compromise and he would listen to his senior devotees. And so what he had done, he had decided there should be two co-presidents, not one president, but two co-presidents, an external president and an internal president. So I was the internal president, and Akshayananda Swami, who was a New Zealand devotee, who I knew, because actually, he joined in Amsterdam, and I shaved them up. So I thought, well, that can't be too bad. And also, he's the external. An external meant that he had to go and travel and preach and make life members and bring all the money back for the temple. So Prabhupada, you know, he made that adjustment and it seemed to fit according to the sannyasi's point of view. Because how could they complain? There was not just the sannyasi, but now also there was two of us. And that's to be continued tomorrow. Because already the time is... Are you liking this journey? This?
Yes. can't get enough of it. It's just amazing how it surrendered all the disciples' problems. He just told you to do something and that was it. You did it. You know, he told what's his name? He went to Delhi.
Tejas.
Tejas means Delhi. Delhi means Tejas means, like, there's nowhere else you're going to go. You're staying in Delhi. It's like, and how much more direct can you get? But I don't see that, like, I don't know if I could, you know, because I haven't, like, grown up in that way. If somebody just told me, okay, you go here and do this, even if it was a spiritual authority, it's like,
yeah, it's a big deal. Yeah, you've got your plans. But the thing is that we had to adjust our plans to fit in with Srila Prabhupada's plans. And Prabhupada liked that, obviously. You know, he was looking for surrendered followers that would, obviously, you know, like I said, Prabhupada said you can surrender everything but your intelligence. You know, he said don't surrender your intelligence to your authorities. So, but I would always check with Prabhupada also, too. Like, you know, I intelligently, you know, thought this whole thing out about Vrindavan. I like Vrindavan, but here was an offer to do something which would increase my preaching abilities. And I thought, well, let me consult with Prabhupada and make sure that I'm doing the right thing. And sure enough, it was the right thing. I said, yes. And I don't mind, as a devil's workshop. So you do this for the time being.
When did he install the Prabhupada?
Oh, they were installed in 1973. In Torumal Lane, I don't know if you know Bengali Market, there's two very famous sweet houses. There's Mohan's, no, Bhimsen, sorry, Bhimsen, and the other one, what's the other one called? You know what I'm talking about? Bengali Market in Delhi? Not far from Connaught Place? Nathu's. Thank you for answering that question. So there's Bhimsen and Nathu's. Nathu's sweetness. And Prabhupada actually liked the sweets made by Nathu's, and he actually told a couple of devotees to go there into the kitchen and learn how they make their sweets. And it just so happened to be just directly across the street from the temple. I thought that was a nice location.
street shot.
Two. Delmuj is a little bit further away, just across the street. Bhim Sen. There's Bhim Sen and Nathus. And they're still there, both of them. They're still churning out the same sweets and the same. Well, there's another thing which is also very tasty, which is called Chana Bhatura. They're also famous for salty things too.
What happened with the letter?
What letter?
This was the person who did. He never mentioned
it.
He didn't get it.
I never asked. Actually, I should have asked, but I just, for some reason, because, you know, obviously I know Brahmananda Gargamuni extremely well, I just never thought about it, you know, whenever I was with them. I was always thinking of something else or asking something or talking about something. But I can always ask them, I suppose. But that was way back in 1974. That's 35 years ago. I don't know if they're... memories is, you know, sharp. Might be. I mean, they're called Scharf. And Scharf is German for sharp. The Scharf brothers, Greg and Bruce.
Yes, Krishna really arranged that that letter should not have been read.
Yeah.
No possible.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for your enthusiastic listening abilities. But you know, I hope you're learning a lot from what we're talking about, because actually this is how we mature. We mature by hearing situations that you may not face in your life, but if you do face those situations, perhaps that, You know what they say, that forewarned is forearmed. Forewarned is forearmed. Not F-O-U-R, F-O-R-E. I'm not looking for forearms. We want to go to Krishna. We want two arms, not four arms. Hare Krishna.
Dhananjay Prabhu ki.